We good? Thank you, Madam Clerk. Welcome to the August 19th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you do need assistance hearing proceedings in chambers today, we do have hearing assist devices stored at the ends of the dais. And with that, if you would please all rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, any changes to today's agenda?
Amendment number one to the August 19th, 2014 Board Agenda. Added item to closed session. 4, conference with legal counsel existing litigation. Number 16, Flores versus County. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement.
Very good. Thank you very much. That brings us to our consent agenda. I do have one request to speak. Dr. C. Height, please.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. And this is item number 2, request to approve a 5-year extension of the rental agreement with the Senior Nutrition Program. And in looking over the paperwork, this nonprofit pays $2,750 a month to feed seniors. And we're also obligated to feed county workers and the general public, which you're letting them off of that contract. And I support, and it's not just a social situation, it is a demand that seniors have a support network, because if they don't have a support network and they're isolated at home and sick, they will end up in an old folks home. So please always see the object of this. It's not about it being fair market value. It's about supporting your seniors so they have a quality of life. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height.
Thank you, Dr. Height. That was our last request to speak. So I'll excuse myself and bring it back to the board, ask colleagues if they have items to pull. Mr. Meacham?
No, sir.
Ms. Ray?
No, sir.
Mr. Hill?
None, sir.
And Ms. Arnold?
No.
I have none myself, so I would entertain a motion to approve.
So moved.
Thank you.
Second.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. And with that, Madam Clerk, a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. That brings us to public comment for items not on our agenda, but within the subject matter jurisdiction of the board. We'll go with the slips that we have on the dais, which number 9 at this point, and we'll start with Eric Greening, followed by Ken Carpenter.
Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and later today you will be doing an event permit for an event that is going to have more than 3,000 people. It is proper that you do this. You kept a cap on the people, the Peter Pan, Never Never Land people who were going to have this. They wanted to have about 11,000 people, I guess adults playing kid while drinking adult beverages. I still am not real clear on that concept. But you followed the law and kept a cap on that since they didn't want to go through the permit process. If we're going to have respect for the law, then the laws that private parties have to abide by need to also be enforced on public government agencies, such as state parks. We have Huckfest coming in October. They're a negative declaration, which they're their own lead agency, the OHV division, is a mess. You need to exert permitting authority not only for equal treatment and respect for the law, but to find out what this event is, because there is tremendous inconsistency within the negative declaration. Project description, quote, all participants and spectators of the event would be paid camping or day use visitors, unquote. And then by going by the legal limits for such, and average vehicle occupancy, they say it will be no more than 11,400. You come to the section on air quality. It says the event would not increase day use and camping limits, but is expected to result in a large number of walk-in visitors that are likely to park in the vicinity of sensitive receptors. What that means, a sensitive receptor is a resident of Oceano who has a nose. So there will be people parking all over Oceano and walking in. The quantity of those people is simply large number. That's as specific as they get. So you would assume this plus the fact that the people going through the gate would be going in surges based on the times of events. You would think that they would have to account for some traffic and transportation impacts. You get to that section of the negative declaration, and under every possible category in that field, they simply say no impact. This negative declaration is a mess. The only way you're going to find out what's going on is to exert the permit authority that private parties have to go through. And if we're going to have respect for the law, the state should have to go through it too. If you can have a hearing now for an event next month, you can schedule a hearing for an event in October, and you'd better get it on the calendar as soon as you can. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Mr. Carpenter, followed by Dr. C. Hyde.
Good morning. Ken Carpenter. I presented all of you with a map of an area of El Pomar and Neal Springs, and I spoke to several county departments and a couple of supervisors even about a vineyard that was put in this year. And they said they would get in touch with code enforcement, check it out, and I kept checking back with them and everything. And they said that they didn't believe that it was in the restricted area. And if you'll see on the map that I gave you, I blacked out this little triangle on the orange and where the blue connects. That's private property. Then I put a line around the entire vineyard property. And if you notice on the right-hand side, I thought it was a severe emergency ordinance, then you should have went and made the whole county, you know, water restricted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carpenter. Dr. Hyde, followed by Ben DeFada.
Dr. C. Hyde, Los Osos. And I first want to thank Supervisor Arnold, the people's supervisor, for speaking up at the last meeting. And actually, there were intelligent people in the audience who stood up and answered questions. And therefore, we in the audience and those who work or are homebound who can't make it into the meetings had some idea how our government was working. Otherwise, they would have no idea. And so I really want to thank you on that. It was an intelligent and confident response. And on the issue of the group homes, and one thing that I want to point out, though, is that even though the county is not affiliated with any Family First group homes, this is a very dangerous time for children in group homes, because Families First was literally the McDonald's of franchises. They have group homes all over California. They were the model of group homes. And when they went down, it took a lot for them to lose their license. And what's going to happen now is that, without a doubt, group homes all over the state are aware of this. And what it means is group homes are going to be more protective of complaints from people who work there and more protective of complaints from children to protect their license. So this is a very troubling time. And where this is in your preview is that you have to take a step beyond just hearing what you want to hear from your providers. It is your responsibility to make sure that there's quality control, that your eyes and ears are open, and that you actually know what's going on within the county. And then on another issue that I have brought before you, Gwen Taylor's statements that there's going to be a economical cleansing of the people of Los Osos. It's coming true. And what I want to ask you today, because I brought my tin cup, what is your policy for begging within the government center or outside of the government center? Because it occurs to me that it would be less humiliating and it would probably be quicker to just beg for the $91 a month that has been put on as a tax to me, because I don't see where the savings is going to come from. I've got two letters from your Department of Social Services. You paid them to manage the Obamacare. Twice they tell me that I'm not eligible. I'm eligible for something else. And this one, there's four copies. This one's there's one. So that's how it's working. It's really an issue for seniors. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Mr. DeFatta, followed by Cindy Steinbeck.
Morning, Board, Sheriff, Public. I'm Ben DeFatta from Los Osos, home of the most expensive, unaffordable, antiquated sewer project in the nation per capita. My comment today is a letter to the editor in last Sunday's Tribune written by Tom Salmon, a longtime resident of Los Osos. His title is Too Little, Too Late. He mentions how the Los Osos Community Service District has now adapted water restrictions in this August 12, 2014, after the Fox has left the in-house. Los Osos and his county's Public Works Department, Gibson, Pavo, Coastal Commission, State and Regional Water Boards, many engineers, contractors, and many other entities has known for at least 20 years that we are in a Level 3 water shortage condition. That was a long time ago. During the construction, when dewatering the high groundwater trenching prior to installing deep pipes, the contractors had pumped a half year's worth of treatable groundwater into Morro Bay. We were told that wouldn't happen. Knowing this, no one from any department, water board, state, local board, coastal commission, Gibson, Pravo, and many others, especially the Los Osos CSD, would intervene to stop this practice of wasting this precious water from going into the bay. This was pointed out many times to this board to stop this dumping of water into the bay by us that came here every week, only to be ignored repeatedly, especially by you, Mr. Gibson. To continue on with Mr. Salmon's comments, common sense should have prevailed to protecting the basin's water supply. He continues to say now that the basin's protection has been put in place by the LOCD, CSD, it is a little too late, unfunded, unenforceable mandate done on purpose. In the light of the 150 million gallons dumped into the bay, the declaration made
28 million acre feet of wet water available, and yet the Department of Water Resources has promised out 153 million acre feet. That is securities fraud, because you cannot sell something that doesn't exist, and that's what they've been doing for at least 10 years. The DWR and Metropolitan Water District have targeted basins all over the state of California, including ours, with the same marketing message. Farmers, agriculture, and rural residents are using too much water. In fact, they're using all of the water, when in fact, private enterprise is setting up, as we speak, in the Paso Robles groundwater basin to sell storage space and water. There are at least four large major ag enterprises right now just east of me that have drilled 16-inch wells, putting in 16-inch pipelines to ship water out of this area. And it's amazing that the city of Paso Robles is going along with this when, in fact, the city of Paso Robles has a higher priority right than the people that are going to be selling this water have. So they're going to give up their rights. And a fact is that when water districts that have been established sue municipalities, water districts win. And that's what we're setting ourselves up for right now. Prags is setting us up with this. Pro Water Equity is setting us up. And county and the cities are going along with this. When, in fact, the attorneys that have been hired, if you look at the firms on their list of clients, are over 100 municipalities in Southern California that need this basin. And I love solutions, but I don't want to be the solution for someone else's problem. And this is very serious, what is happening now. I say fraud, security violation, illegal behavior, And if we don't take a step back, we're going to get sucked into this like other basins have been sucked in. And I don't think any of you want that for this basin or this county. So I beg you, while we can, look at the facts and step back and say what is going on statewide and really take a look at this before we dive in headfirst. I have a press release from the event that was filed against the DWR that I have copies for you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Steinbeck. Mr. Kirkland, followed by Lindy Owen.
Thank you very much. I want to speak today about what's going on with our county in terms of both water and global warming. If we're going to punish the farmers and ranchers, which Cindy was just talking about, by restricting their ability to find water and use water, we should also do it to the tourist industry and restrict hotels and any other industry that uses water and restrict their amount of water that they may use so we don't punish just one industry. And if the county's going to start punishing businesses and homes by not using too much water, we need to punish all businesses. On that note, going on global warming, one of the things we need to do if we're going to, and I hear this presented, that we're going to have to stop global warming by preventing people from driving, we need to stop people from coming into this county on automobiles or vehicles. So we should restrict recreational vehicles from coming into the county. And on that note, the county is in the business of airplanes. We have an airport here that's run by the county, as I understand it. And airplanes cause a tremendous amount of pollution because they burn fuel, according to the people who believe that carbon dioxide is a pollutant, and I don't. And I think global warming is a good idea. But if we're going to do that, we need to shut down the airport and start people coming here in Costoga wagons, as they did 150 years ago, pulled by mules. And if we're serious about stopping global warming, we need to stop tourism in this county and stop the airport and stop anybody from coming here and using oil in any way and cut down the population of this county and make it so it's non-economically viable if we're going to stop global warming around the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kirkland. Ms. Owen, followed by Julie Tacker.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos Watchdog. I again come to speak as probably the most important subject in this county is water. And I want to, we had that letter to the editor that was from Tom Salmon discussing the option of dumping a quarter of a year's worth of both water companies' supply into the bay instead of following through with what was a condition to bring that water up on top of Broderson, which we had leach fields designed for. Not that they were timed right. Nothing's timed right with a sewer. But they were also the water was also supposed to go to the Midtown site, the Tri-W area. All of that failed, and it became obvious that it was more expensive to do that is that that project is going to fail to begin with. But now that they've cut out the trees and they've got the area in there, now they're planting it with native plants, which is kind of crazy too because there's going to be it's going to be too moist for native plants. But the worst part is that they're watering it with drinking supply again. Now, the middle of town was a similar project. It was supposed to be re-established habitat. And Mr. Gibson said that we were waiting for rain. That was why that never got watered. Everything we put into that property died. Some of the natives came back, and yes, we have some lupin in there, but the whole project was a failure. So now we didn't put water on the Midtown site where we look at it. It's our community center. But we're going ahead and using our drinking supply again to water native plants up on a hill that barely anybody sees. And at this point, why are we watering those when we couldn't water the project in the Midtown? Thank you.
Ms. Owen, Ms. Tacker, followed by Mary Lucy.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker, and I would like to cover the subject that Mr. Greening touched on and some ironies, some inconsistencies in how you are treating events. Forever Neverland expected 10,000 people with staff, nearly 11,000 people. They were to have parking and shuttles to bring the people into the quaint community of Avila Beach. The Saver event in Santa Margarita to protect the residents of Santa Margarita. There again will be shuttles. I did thumb through the Saver event. They're offering to have 44 chemical toilets on site. For this last year, they had 7,200 people. It's likely they will have more this year. But the Huckfest event, while State Parks admits to 11,400 people, last year had over 20,000 people. The Huckfest website admits their intention is to go higher than that, and they will have 30 chemical toilets. So being a bit of an armchair sewer specialist out of Los Osos, I see a problem with just handling human waste. Furthermore, the cumulative impacts are—they're really in this CEQA document. They're really only looking at the impacts to the dunes, which I think are understated. But if you look beyond there, and you look at where their water comes from, where their sewage goes to, where their public resources are coming from—the Sheriff's Department, Five Cities Fire Authority, Cal Fire—those impacts are going to be significant, but they're not recognized in this document. Furthermore, this is the same weekend as the Pismo Clam Festival, where more resources are being impacted. More water, more sewage, more traffic, more impacts. But I don't hear anyone speaking up for the little special town of Oceana. I don't hear it. It's silent. And that bothers me. I look to my 4th District Supervisor. I think she needs backup from the 3rd District Supervisor. And as all of us look at how precious the resources are in this county, we need to back up Oceano. We all need to back up the community of Oceano, as this one event will have a significant impact.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Ms. Lucy.
Good morning. My name is Mary Lucy. I live in Oceano. I want to thank you for taking the, giving me 3 minutes to speak on behalf of the people of Oceano. I want to thank Mr. Green for laying out the legalities of this festival and other festivals and the importance of being consistent in festivals and events across this county. Tourism is important to the county as a whole. The Huckfest is being organized in kind of in a vacuum, in a sense. The community hasn't been involved. It's between state parks, the CHP, the organizers, but there's no community component in that. What has been said through state parks is they will come and report to us. They will advise the advisory committee on how they're going to move forward. Our concern is that there is only two roads in to the Strands. There are residents in there. There are people who have their family reunions in there. They will be disrupted. You will not be able to get into the Strands area. The parking is very, very limited now. We have people calling up wanting to rent houses for big, huge tow trucks, bringing in big, huge trucks, 8 cars at minimum, 6 cars at minimum. They've been coming there for 20 years. So it's more of an economic impact than I think that parks and recs are disclosing to the county of San Luis Obispo. So I strongly encourage you to take a second look, a third look, maybe ask parks and recs what would be the harm in including community advocates who understand the impact that it will have on this area. Last year it just turned us upside down. It really did. I live over on 23rd, and there was trash all the way over to 23rd. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lucy. That was our last request to speak, so we'll close public comment and bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to address a couple of issues that were raised regarding the well issue that Mr. Carpenter raised. Staff did go out and take a look at that. Code enforcement looked at that. That well is located in the Atascadero sub-basin, so that's why they were allowed to go forward. And the other issue that was raised by Ms. Steinbeck about the export, we will be bringing forth a no export out of San Luis County ordinance before too long, if I'm not mistaken.
All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Neal?
Rita Neal, County Council. Staff does intend to bring a business item to the board on September 9th to discuss what's been called an anti-export ordinance, really a permitting process, and we'll be looking for direction from the board at that time moving forward with an ordinance.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. With that, we will move on and ask Madam Clerk to introduce our next item, please.
Item number 8, submittal of a report on the status of Affordable Care Act implementation in San Luis Obispo County, all districts.
All right. Thank you. One of the most significant initiatives and changes in the county health care system. Mr. Collins, would you like to illuminate us on the questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Good morning. Lee Collins from the Department of Social Services, and I will be joined at the other podium by our very able and assistant director, Tracy Shiro. Some of you know I try not to bring her around too often for fear that you might begin to ask, what do we need him for? So there I go, saying it out loud.
Can I ask that?
About a year ago, I came before your board with the request to add 24 positions to our department pursuant to funding that we received to implement the Affordable Care Act. And at that time, I said, you know, we understand that people have various opinions about the Affordable Care Act. We don't have the luxury of having an opinion. We are only charged with implementing it. And so today what I wanted to present to you is a little history of that implementation. What I will not be talking about is the actual access to health, issues with the MISP program that are the program operated by the health agency, signing up physicians and health plan. That's not what we do in the Department of Social Services. Our job is to sign people up. And so with that, as you know, the act was signed into law by President Obama after a great deal of controversy on March 23rd, 2010. Beginning immediately, the state began passing its legislation that would enable the program to take effect here, establishing the benefit package that was essentially the existing Medi-Cal package of benefits. Existing programs were folded in to the new program, the low-income health program. San Luis Obispo County was one of a handful of counties that did not have that program, but there was the Healthy Families program, and we moved over 5,000 children from that separate program into the Medi-Cal program, and it became part of the responsibility of DSS. The other bullet points that you see are ones that have been talked about before in terms of the actual provisions of the Affordable Care Act and the limitations that it placed on insurance companies to deny access to care to certain individuals. The next decision that California had to make, as did every other state, is whether to establish its own exchange for the provision of private health insurance or to let the federal government operate the exchange. California, as you know, chose to operate its own. The next decision juncture that it had was to consider whether to use the existing computer networks that every county utilizes. We in San Luis Obispo are part of a consortium of 18 counties using this CalWIN system. All of our public assistance programs are integrated into that system, and there are two other systems as well in the state that other counties may be enrolled in. Another possibility was for the state to completely build its own system from scratch. And there were some up there who had the idea that perhaps all health programs would be centralized and operated by the state. And they began moving in that direction, located in Fresno and Sacramento and Contra Costa County, would ask a few preliminary questions in a screening process and determine whether the individual was applying for private insurance under the exchange, in which case they would handle the application, or whether the individual was more likely eligible for expanded Medi-Cal. And part of the concept that the state was urging was horizontal integration, which is to say that someone applying for one program should at the same time be able to have their eligibility for other programs examined. And if they were found eligible for other programs, to give them the opportunity to apply for those as well. San Luis Obispo County was uniquely situated in this regard because we had integrated programs with staff years ago. Many counties still had specialists. You went to one person for your CalFresh program. You went to a different person to apply for Medi-Cal, and even a third person if you wanted to apply for the CalWORKS program. Those counties had a much more difficult time retraining and adjusting than San Luis Obispo, who had already implemented this years before. I don't know why I seem to have trouble with my mouse up here. Expectations were established for these call centers. They would be open, including ours, Monday through Saturday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., hours for working people. 80% of calls received had to be answered within 30 seconds. These were the standards. 3% or fewer of persons who called would abandon the call because they just weren't being helped. And 0% would get a busy signal. And later we'll tell you how we all did. You can see that two universities and the state California Department of Healthcare Services, through analyses of demographics and census records and everything else, predicted the number of applications each county would receive. It was predicted that we would process 9,179 applications for the expanded Medi-Cal and a little over 5,700 for Covered California, for a total of just about 15,000. Based on those estimates, the state allocated $2.2 million to the county for each of 2 years, last year and this year. And the agreement at that time was that was a fixed amount. It was considered more than the state thought we needed. It was considered less than we thought we needed. And so we compromised and said, guarantee it for 2 years, and then we'll see where we go from there. A year ago, April, I brought before your board a contract with IntelliGy to put together this call center. It had to have very specific technical requirements about recording calls and monitoring our performance so that the state would know whether we were keeping up our part of the bargain about no busy signals, calls answered under 30 seconds, and so forth. And then, as I mentioned at the beginning, just about a year ago, I requested the additional 24 staff members to implement the program. So on October 1st, in a somewhat festive occurrence, we opened our call center and prepared to take the onslaught of telephone calls that we had been told to expect, the first of which arrived at about 3 o'clock that afternoon, which was transferred to us by one of the state call centers, where we were told that this individual in San Luis Obispo County spoke only Russian, and here comes the call. And we were concerned about that because there was no one in our call center who spoke Russian, but as it turns out, the person was not from San Luis Obispo County, did not speak Russian, and in other, many other ways was nothing that the state call center told us. Volume then began to pick up. You'll recall that for the Medi-Cal program, we were told to expect about 9,179 applications over this 6 month or over this open enrollment period. In fact, we received significantly more than that. We received 13,176 applications that involved more than 18,000 individuals actually applying for Medi-Cal. We were told that in Covered California for applications under the exchange that about 5,756 applications could be expected. We more than doubled that with 12,256 applications from individuals applying for that coverage. The total then, we've been told, you'll recall, that it was going to be just about 15,000. It was not that. It was 25,000 cases. So during that enrollment period, Over 30,000 report from Kaiser Health Foundation, 60% of them actually used the insurance to go to a doctor, to get a prescription, things that they had not been able to do before. You'll recall the performance standards. On the left are the county's call centers. These, when I say counties, these are the 18 counties of which we are a member. Our performance, although we don't have it specifically for all of these, was actually better than our 18-county average. 80% of calls answered within 30 seconds. We did 99% as a consortium. The state's performance was 0.4% of calls answered within 30 seconds. Calls abandoned, 1.2% for the counties, 57% for the state's call centers. Busy signals, counties had none. State had 54%. As this became clear, we began telling people, don't go through the state. Don't go through the state's website. Don't call the 800 number. Don't call the call center, because it is a recipe for frustration for you. And by the time you finally get to us, you're going to be so frustrated and angry that you're going to take it out on us, because we're going to be the first real person you talk to. So we told our partners, we told the community, don't call the 800 number. Come to us. Now, we gained nothing from that. It was just more work for which we were not compensated. I mean, we had a flat amount of staffing and financing to do this. But it was so clear that the community was becoming frustrated with this state call center that again, we told everyone every time we had a chance, come to us. We will help you navigate this system. Because the problems just went on and on. Even for us, it was maddening. The interface between the state system and the county system that had been promised October 1st, 2013, didn't work. We said, be ready, January 1st it'll work. January 1st, it did not work. Today is August 19th. It does not work today. What this means is that there are bottlenecks when folks continue to try to use the state system. Cases get stuck. For us, we've been able to find ways to do workarounds, but these programming errors, these other delays, the problems with the call centers, the poor training, the poor staffing that that was the experience of the state call center has continued to plague our ability to make this system work. But we're trying. Very recently, we were told this letter was going to go out, and I would draw your attention to the bold in the second paragraph. The state is sending this letter. It says, what happened to my health insurance application? Oh, we're sorry. We have so many applications and computer problems. These are the state's computer problems, and they are, at our request, sending this letter out to everybody saying, we're sorry. So what we're doing is double entry. We have to enter the same information in the state system and our system. We have found manual workarounds through the help of some very, very talented IT staff that are working in our department. We had a backlog of 9,000 applications that we were trying to get through the system. And we put everybody on this task. We authorized overtime. We are now down to fewer than 2,000. For any case during this time where someone contacted us and said, I need to see the doctor, and they're not going to see me if I don't have, we would pull that one to the top and process it. We would prioritize the processing on these. These that we have now, the under 2,000, these are challenging cases because they were packaged and sent to us by the state, and information doesn't match. A social security number may be off, or other identifying information. So we have problems, but we're continuing to work on that. Now I'm going to turn it over to Tracy to talk about the special populations that we've been working.
Good morning. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the special populations. In addition to the community that would be applying for health care, we already identified special populations that we'd be able to transition. The County Medical Services Program is one of those. Prior to Affordable Care Act, those that were ages 18 to 64 without what we called linkage to Medi-Cal did not receive the staff that determined eligibility to CMSP. We transferred them over to social services. They participated in our training class and are serving those applicants and participants through our office. Another special population was homeless and general assistance. This is a primary focus for our Benefit Arch staff who assist the disabled homeless in our community to obtain health care, financial stability, and housing. Again, this is a population that could not obtain their health care, could not develop that file, and could not move forward in applying for disability if they're disabled, or get well and get back to work. So we're helping in both of those areas. Many of our general assistance recipients are also homeless. We're currently serving about 240 general assistance individuals per month, and work with them to transition them all onto to Medi-Cal and helping them obtain financial stability, either getting back to work or getting their Social Security disability. These are also a population who are suffering with mental health and drug and alcohol issues, and with the expanded Medi-Cal for them, they're able to obtain those services. Another population, speaking of captive audiences, was our jail inmate population. We now have a staff person at the jail. He is there every single day. He meets with groups of inmates. He also meets with them individually and takes their Medi-Cal application or works with them if they've already got other health care. To date, we've taken over 500 applications, and at least 150 have left jail with a Medi-Cal card in their hand, which enables them to obtain services upon release. In the past, they weren't able to obtain those services. So with that Medi-Cal card, we can direct them directly to mental health, drug and alcohol services, the clinics, and they can get the care that they need upon release. What's next? We are completing the processing of our backlog. As Lee explained, we've got just about just under 2,000 that we're working on, and our goal is, of course, to get those finished by open enrollment, which is November 15th. However, our staff have just really committed and dedicated, and their goal is to finish it prior to that. So now their latest is about mid-September that they're aiming on getting that done. They're working overtime. They're working together. That backlog aren't assigned cases. They're treating them as if they belong to everyone, and they're approaching that on a regular basis. We're addressing the state's problems with renewals. Every Medi-Cal case needs to be renewed every year. The problem that we're having that Lee explained with the computer systems affects this issue as well. We don't have the ability from the state's perspective to send out any kind of notices for these renewals. So what the state had asked us to do is just to hang on to those, yet creating another backlog. That doesn't serve our community very well. So we are addressing those and have developed a workaround for that as well. We prioritize those that will affect a family positively. So any family that has changes that will reduce their share of cost for a month, will add family members into their case, we are taking those to the top and processing those cases and then working our way through the rest of them as well so that we don't have a backlog in that area as well. Preparing for next open enrollment. Call center staff are continuing to work these cases, continuing to work these backlogs of cases, but they haven't had phone calls in the call center like they do during open enrollment. So they're staffing up again. We're getting ready to redirect some staff to the call center so that we'll be able to meet all of those mandates again this year. And we also anticipate that because of the advertising of open enrollment, we will probably get more Medi-Cal applications as well. So, Lee mentioned that we're open from Monday to Saturday during open enrollment. We also were open on Sundays, many Sundays, and we anticipate that to happen this time as well. We'll continue to exert pressure on the state. They really do need to get their computer systems fixed. They need to manage their backlog, and they need to send us the cases so that we can serve those in our community. We meet at many different levels on a weekly basis, by phone, and on a monthly basis. Our San Luis Obispo staff and the workarounds that they've created have actually been able to share ideas and fixes with the state. So we're trying to be part of the solution as we exert that pressure. Again, we're continuing to provide the best public service possible.
This fell short of charming for us. And we have been somewhat vocal in our concerns about the state's ability to run this program.
Thank you for the update here, but taking off from that, I guess that's the big question. And do I get it right that with the 20,000 Medi-Cal enrollees we have in this county, we're going to be looking at having to renew them every year, renew their not membership, but eligibility for Medi-Cal?
Yes.
That is part of the Medi-Cal program. They are required to report significant changes at any time.
Right.
If someone gets a job, if someone leaves home, they have 10 days within which to report that. Mm-hmm. But everyone must, once a year, and it's staggered throughout the year based on when they first came on to assistance, they're required to submit essentially a brand new set of forms that renew their eligibility. When there are no changes, it's a fairly simple process. When there are changes, it becomes a little more complicated. But one way or another, every one of them must be processed by staff.
I guess where I was going with that is it seems like there's yet a great deal of work to do, even in the routine maintenance of this with the increased Medi-Cal load. I'm interested and obviously concerned with your staffing levels, and it sounds like those 24 positions aren't going to go away anytime soon because there's important work that they need to do. You'd referenced the couple million dollars a year, I guess, that the state provided us as part of affordable health care implementation and that realignment. I'm curious, do we have expectation that funding is going to continue?
My expectation is that the funding is going to increase. Okay. It could increase in the current year, not because we have the ability to make them do it. A deal was a deal, and we agreed to 2 years of level funding. But we have advocates in the legislature who have said no one expected these kinds of numbers. And the deal that the counties and the state cut was a good faith deal at the time, but let's be realistic. It's not happening. Right. So we could see an augmentation in the current year. I am quite sure we will see an augmentation in the next year.
Okay.
And that would be part of our budget submission for next year.
And this problem must be the inability of the state and local computer systems to coordinate effectively must be a problem for all of your colleagues in the other 57 counties.
It is. When you look at the backlogs that were created by this, I think that San Luis Obispo has been a little more proactive in terms of finding ways to do these workarounds, committing the overtime. Some counties wouldn't authorize it. Some counties didn't have the funding. We did.
And where I was going with that is that I'm curious as to when you or your state association thinks that the state is going to get their computer system corrected. And when are we going to be on a better track of that coordination that was supposed to have happened long ago?
Well, Supervisor Gibson, one thing I remember hearing once is that the bad part about being an optimist is that you can never be pleasantly surprised.
Right.
I don't have confidence in them. They have shown us nothing to suggest that they're ever going to really get it together, not even by first not admitting there was a problem, second by trying to pretend that it was someone else's problem, and third dragging their heels in fixing the problem. So I don't have any particular confidence that it's going to be fixed anytime soon. There is this hubris among some of them that that they know what they're doing when they don't. And, you know, we're going to keep doing the best that we can. People can apply for Medi-Cal all year long. The open enrollment is for application under Covered California. But it also has, that is publicized in the media, there are folks who emerge and say, well, I want to apply. And it turns out they're actually Medi-Cal. It's called the woodworking effect in our business. So we know that we're going to have another surge of activity, and we expect that there will be new problems.
Okay. Let me go. I have Supervisor Hill and Supervisor Meacham with questions at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the ARCH program, I wanted to ask a couple questions, if I could, Lee or Tracy. How has the ARCH program been affected? Are the caseloads higher, and are we seeing better outcomes? Are we seeing more people getting their benefits? And then a follow-up after that, if I could.
You know, first of all, it's been successful beyond what we predicted. And this is the program where persons who are disabled, who have difficulty applying for disability under the Social Security Act, we provided that as CARE Act. They are eligible for Medi-Cal without having to be disabled. So we're getting them Ms. Shiro said, we're getting them signed up right away so they can access services.
And do we have case managers working with them after they receive the benefits? After, you know, some of the folks that were helping to get benefits, they're eligible for mentally disabled, homeless folks. Where does our outreach end?
The point of the Benefits ARCH program was solely to help them access benefits for which they were eligible. So it was not intended to be a social case management model. And the staff who work in that program are not social workers. They are employment resource workers. So we get them signed up. We get the check in their hand, the Medi-Cal card in their hand, and CalFresh. We do not help them manage life situations at this point.
So is that a gap that we're seeing? Because if we're getting mentally disabled, homeless folks, chronically homeless folks, the benefits that they're eligible for, and that's all we're doing, then obviously there's going to be a whole host of other problems that arise from that.
And I think that is a contract that your board is going to be considering on its agenda next week, where the county let an RFP seeking applicants to do case management for the most disabled homeless in our community.
And will we see, if I could, not to preview too much, Lee, will we see a correlation between the people that we've successfully helped get the benefits for the ARCH program and the people that we hope to see case managed in the chronically homeless population?
It would be my expectation that there would be some crossover. It would certainly be my expectation that those who are identified as most vulnerable and eligible for services under the homeless case management piece, that we would be prioritizing them for accessing benefits that would help lead them toward a more secure and self-sufficient situation.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lee, you suggested that the program has been successful through the Department of Social Services. And yet you said also that you have little confidence in the state's ability to perform. What effect will that have on our success as we go forward?
Well, it's a stumbling block. You know, it continues to be a stumbling block. These 2,000 applications, if they had been, or that are part of our backlog, had they been handled correctly initially, there wouldn't be a backlog. We would have been able to handle those. So, you know, I don't question the wisdom of the state's original plan. Their thought was that that they would be a one-stop shop. Call this 800 number, and we'll help you. We're going to no wrong door. We're going to process your application if it's Covered California. We're going to rocket your call down to the county of residence, and they will handle your Medi-Cal case. Conceptually, it was great. But they understaffed their call centers. They did not, they did not train them properly. They did not get the systems set up to handle the volume, even had the volume been much less. You know, it was it was poor planning on their part.
Well, I guess my point, though, is that if, even if they were to become more efficient,
mm-hmm.
or as we continue down this road, do you see that even more personnel isn't going to help us if they can't get the efficiency corrected at the state level? Is that fair to say?
Well, first of all, I don't expect another year to look anything like this last year. This was the year of initial implementation.
Right.
Next year, I don't see the numbers being that large. Secondly, as Supervisor Gibson mentioned, we now have 20,000 cases rather than 11,000 that are going to require an annual renewal. And, you know, it's up to us to ensure the integrity of the program by processing those, to ensure that participants in these programs have their benefits calculated accurately, and to ensure that, you know, the taxpayers aren't paying benefits for someone who doesn't qualify for them. So the expectation going forward is still daunting and still requires that level of staffing and more.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Collins. Ms. Shiro, appreciate the update.
Much. We
understand the importance of this and look forward to future success, however it might come.
So do we.
Excellent. Madam Clerk, would you introduce our next item, please? I'm sorry. You're quite correct. I will open it to public comment. I don't have any requests to speak, so I will close it to public comment and bring it back for conclusion and then the introduction of the next item. Thank you much.
Item number 9, submittal of a resolution to...
What you see there is the boundaries of the zone, and the blue line is the main distribution line. Focusing in a little bit, our Zone 3 customers who receive the water from Lopez and pay the vast majority of costs for the system includes the city of Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, and Pismo, also the Oceano Community Services District. County Service Area 12 in the upper left, the Avila Valley and Avila Beach, includes the Avila Beach Community Services District, Avila Valley Mutual Water Company, Port San Luis Harbor, San Luis Coastal Unified School District, and at least 16 private water contracts to individual properties. By way of background, Rio Grande Creek Watershed at Lopez Dam produces a safe yield of 8,730 acre-feet of water on average per year. As your staff report points out, safe yield is the amount of water that's theoretically available at a given location in a watershed on an annual basis over the long term. So that given location is Lopez Dam. Of that 8,730 acre-feet, 52% is contracted to municipal agencies in Zone 3 that we just listed. The balance of the safe yield is available for downstream lease, although that is not by contract. It is simply the unused safe yield. When we look just at our Zone 3 contractors, we can see that the water is divided as shown above. I should point out these numbers don't reflect a couple of side agreements between agencies. For instance, CSA 12 and Pismo Beach have a side agreement, so you'll see a very similar table here and there, slightly different numbers. These are just the base contract amounts. So per the water contracts, what we're talking about today is what happens when the water that's delivered to agencies is less than 4,530 acre-feet in a single year, or what happens if the amount of water that's released downstream is less than 4,200 acre-feet. Or put it another way, what if the Lopez project delivers in a single year water that's less than the annual safe yield? That's where the term surplus comes from. We have to pause a moment. This is a term of art in the contracts. We see it in a lot of water contracts. Just want to point out it doesn't mean that there's all kinds of water out there that doesn't have a use or isn't accounted for. I put a couple of, Webster definitions. These are actually dictionary.com. Surplus water is the last one there. It's amount of water that's in excess of what is needed to supply the water supply contracts. So, again, going back to 8730, if our total released in a single year is below that, then we have a surplus for the contracts. When we look at the contracts, it defines surplus water this way. The basic definition is it's that portion of the 8730 remaining after distribution of water during the previous year. So what we're talking about today is the amount of water remaining from last water year, that is April 1st to March 31st, April 2013 to March 2014. The contracts further state that we calculate for each water year surplus water by subtracting from the 8730 the downstream lease and the quantity of entitlement water delivered. I want to make that point. Not the total amount of water delivered to agencies, but the total amount of entitlement water. So I just want to walk through how that calculation works. Similar numbers from the previous table. Note the columns for contractor there on the left. The contract amount, also known as entitlement, and the downstream release, and then the total safe yield across the bottom at 8730. As we look at this, per the contracts, we look at the amount of water that was delivered in 13-14 last year. We see that the total amount down here, 9077, does exceed the safe yield. But that includes, as you can see in this column, surplus water from the year before. That does not figure into the calculation. Remember, the contracts say undelivered entitlement, undelivered downstream. So we look here, downstream at 4,200, we only delivered 3,799, so we left 401 acre feet undelivered downstream water. We also see among the contractors looking at entitlement amounts, not last year's surplus, just entitlement amounts. There's a 100 there. Undelivered entitlements, so we add those two, 104, 101, we get the 501 for a calculation of surplus water year from last year. Now, I need to note, and this is in your staff report, this is where the controversy lies, one element of the controversy, and the issue is the accounting method. The method I've just described to you was used from the inception of the project and a concern about flooding. We now find ourselves in a drought condition, and we believe it's important that we avoid water counting methods that will, in a very short number of years, actually produce calculations that bear no relation to what's actually in the reservoir for delivery. That wet winter method was intended to increase use, not necessarily to generate storage for later use, although it is available. That's not the end of the story, however, on surplus water and where we find ourselves in the South County. Zone 3 customers, our South County agencies, have three basic water sources. Surface storage in Lopez Lake, imported water through the State Water Project, and groundwater. I want to focus on groundwater for a moment and highlight this report. Northern Cities Management Area 2013 Annual Monitoring Report. Northern Cities Management Area, the NCMA. By way of background, or the question is, what the heck is the NCMA and what do they have to do with Zone 3? The Santa Maria Groundwater Basin, as you know, is adjudicated. It's divided into three management areas. The northern part of that is the Northern Cities Management Area. That corresponds to the central part, the NMMA, Napomo Mesa Management Area, and then southerly to the Santa Maria Valley Management Area. This is the 2013 Annual Monitoring Report for Groundwater that the NCMA member agencies have produced. It's an excellent document. It's contained in your staff report. It's important to note that the NCMA agencies are the three cities and the community of Oceano. So it's all of Zone 3 except for the Avila Valley. The same folks dealing with groundwater here and Lopez water through Zone 3. So the NCMA and Zone 3 tend to work very well together. I want to show you this map from that annual report and highlight this line. This is a groundwater elevation map. Here we have the five cities area, Cienega Valley, Lower Rio Grande Valley, and off to the side, the Napomo Mesa. This report covers this area. You can see the dune lakes down in the south. This is the five-foot water contour. That means groundwater is 5 feet above sea level, and then increasing as we go east. This was in April 2013. In October 2013, that 5-foot line moved all the way across the valley. We generated a zero elevation line here at sea level and a depression 5 feet deep there. The report has a lot of data that backs up this situation. So what we see in the South County is a serious concern about this decline in groundwater levels and the specter of seawater intrusion into this basin because of these depressions. From the same report, from 1999 to 2013, this is NCMA, so it's Zone 3 minus the Avila Valley, which admittedly is a small part of Zone 3. We see the water use. The blue at the bottom is groundwater, the middle is Lopez, the top is state water. The red line represents the average agricultural use. So we can see here that groundwater is an important portion of the South County city's water supply. We know, going into next year, and as we discussed last week, that we can continue to supply this increment of state water. What we're concerned about is this increment here, which is some 1,400 acre feet. We believe that it's appropriate to address that with your action today based on this table. So this is the 5-year deliveries in downstream versus Shea Field for Lopez. We went back 5 years. We looked at all the annual municipal deliveries and what they total. We looked at annual downstream releases, what they total. We compared these totals to the annual Shea Field, 8730, and it shows 805 acre feet left in the reservoir below 8730, 1600 acre feet left in the reservoir, 345 left in the reservoir. With the onset of the drought, we began to tap that water through the surplus water calculations, but we still have 2,327 acre feet in the reservoir above the 5-year safe yield. So, as the staff report points out, we've coined the term emergency drought relief water. This is not in the contracts. It's based on your board's March 11, 2014 proclamation of a local emergency. We believe it's necessary to fully respond to something called a low reservoir response plan. That's in the agency, the city's letter, and the Oceano Community Services District letter in your staff report. That's a plan to manage the reservoir through the drought period. The agencies are making excellent progress on that. The Zone 3 Advisory Committee considered all of these elements and requested that your board make available not less than 2,327 acre feet, and that is the number that is above the 5-year safe yield. So our recommendation is to adopt the resolution to declare surplus and emergency drought relief water in amount not less than 2,327 acre feet, and find that this action is exempt from CEQA. If your board does adopt the resolution, our next steps would be to maximize the Lopez deliveries, as we have been doing since April 1st, to continue to work in support of and alongside the Zone 3 agencies in developing the low reservoir response plan. There is a schedule in your staff report that the agencies have put forth. That's going to be worked on with the members of the agricultural communities towards the end of this month, and then we hope to bring that to the Zone 3 Advisory Committee in September, and then to the Board of Supervisors at the first available meeting that has time to discuss that. As I mentioned last week at your one-year look ahead, we would also plan to bring this issue, the low reservoir response plan, back to the board along with other county water issues in December, with an update in light of the weather conditions and predictions that we will have at that time. As always, conservation is key. I'm available for any questions that your board may have.
Thank you, Mr. Hutchinson. Indeed, colleagues do. We'll start with Supervisor Ray and then Supervisor Hill.
Mark, can you explain, having come from the other side of the fence here, the cities and their planning have planned based on past practice and what we've done, what the county has done in the past. So if we're doing this as a kind of stopgap and agreed upon action for the water year 14-15 only, why is it that we're not just doing what we did last year in order to make things not only easy from really just a simplified point of view of what we're actually trying to do with regard to surplus water, but secondly making it following what cities had planned based around past practice? In other words, why are we changing it up right now if we're only going to use this through March 31st?
Well, I think, as I noted, actual past practice for 40 years was using the methodology that I described. If we do the carryover method and apply basic drought scenarios, we will very, very rapidly generate surplus water calculations that exceed the amount of water that's in the reservoir.
I think you're misunderstanding my question. So I'm not talking about using that calculation going forward. I'm only talking about using what we did last year and the year before in this year, putting a stop on that on March 31st pending. I'm not talking about using that for future planning.
Well, I do want to note, when it became evident that because we're in a drought and that this declaration would need to come before your board, it's important to consider all of the implications and all of the methodologies that were used. We do have downstream interests. We do have a water rights permit, which I think we're in compliance with. We think it's important during drought conditions to stick as closely as possible with actual contract terms and then make additional water available based on the drought, not on interpretations of contracts that after review we've concluded are in fact not correct. I think there's a certain exposure there that we don't need to take, and that the water supply for the South County from Lopez is much more secure using the methodology that we've described.
Let me just add to that briefly. Dan Buckshy, County Administrator. You know, there have been numerous discussions on this topic going back to the March time frame, and we've been working diligently with all of the partners to try to get to a point to where we can find a middle ground here in terms of how to proceed. You know, one of the challenges with this is that, as Mark has clearly noted, is that there was a change in methodology in order to deal with flooding. And what we're looking at now is that different methodology still appropriate to use given that we are now in a drought? And that is really the crux of this issue, is how to calculate this going forward. And to get to your question, Supervisor Ray, about why not continue with the calculation for this next year and then maybe change it next year at some point into the future, that's obviously an option. But in some of our discussions with the Zone 3 members, they've indicated that they would like to see this alternate formula be used.
More water so that they can, you know, stop the groundwater pumping. But has Zone 3 agency been negotiating with the other interests, the agricultural interests? And I bring that up. I see my friend Brian Talley out there, who certainly represents a specific agricultural interest in the area. I mean, has that been, because the cities, I think, have made clear, in both in discussions that we've had with some of the city managers and mayors and city engineers, but I don't know to what extent we've addressed agricultural interest or even environmental interest as we move forward.
Yes, Mr. Hill. The first off, the agricultural interests are represented on the Zone 3 Advisory Committee as a voting member, which is important. As I mentioned, the Zone 3 agencies are working on the details of the low reservoir response plan, working through various delivery and downstream release scenarios. So the very next step, actually, the meeting is coming together for the end of this month, is to fully engage the agricultural community members and walk them through what we see, what the various scenarios are, and get their full input and opinion in the low reservoir response plan before it goes to the advisory committee.
Okay. Very good. Yeah, I'm interested to hear from our cities.
Yeah, we have some folks here. So, Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, that map you showed us of the report that was done and that salt water or the groundwater levels that have creeped back in further, Is that part of the plan you're talking about is if the reservoir starts to get to the point that it can't release this water, what's the plan to prevent the saltwater intrusion if they have to go back to groundwater pumping?
Well, I guess giving you a preview, the low reservoir response plan, the basic concept is using a reservoir level of 20,000 acre feet, which is based on historical analysys of the reservoir.
It's becoming hysterical, I can tell you.
We look back at the history of the reservoir. And 20,000 acre feet was set as a trigger point back in 2009 when this low reservoir response plan concept was adopted by Zone 3 and the previous Board of Supervisors. So starting at 20,000 acre feet, the concept is to make predictable reductions in municipal deliveries and predictable reductions in downstream releases. So maximizing conservation, additional conservation year over year. The low reservoir response plan, we're attempting to get 3, maybe 4 years out of the reservoir under continued drought scenarios. Those can be highly variable. Essentially, the low reservoir response plan ends when the reservoir stops producing water. The question then becomes, have we backed off the groundwater pumping enough to allow the cities to use at high conservation levels back to groundwater supplies? The thought being that pumping the groundwater when it's declining at the rate we see raises that risk of seawater intrusion, which is either permanent or long-term damage to the groundwater. So we hold that off as long as we can, and then if the Zone 3 cities need to go back to groundwater, they're pumping the minimal amount.
So when it gets to a certain reservoir level, it has to stop, but does this Zone 3 committee, the advisory committee, do they make the recommendation to either lower that further, or how does that work? To allow more releases at a certain level?
Oh, well, the ultimate decision will come before your Board of Supervisors because it is an advisory committee. The reservoir itself, at about the 4,000 acre feet in storage, the infrastructure, the release tower and all of that stuff is no longer capable of moving water.
Right.
Now, we start getting down close to that, there's talk and probably action about measuring the depth to the mud in the bottom of the reservoir, how much of the 4,000 acre feet is water and how much is mud. It's pretty extreme, but what are the costs of, say, floating a barge with a pump and pumping below 4,000 acre feet to get it through the water treatment plant? There's all kinds of technical issues that we've identified. You know, the water treatment plant itself has a minimum run number. We don't think we can pump water out of the reservoir at 6 million gallons a day like we're delivering now. But as we go year over year into the drought, all of those conversations and everyone in the Zone 3 Technical Advisory Committee is aware of these details. So, again, if the drought continues, the measures get a bit more, unusual, I guess.
Thanks, Mark.
Ms. Arnold.
Thank you. So, Mark, I just want to kind of go back. You gave us a little bit of the history.
My understanding is those decisions were made at a staff and technical advisory committee level, and they were facing alternatives, suggestions that, well, gosh, maybe as the reservoir approaches full, we should let more water out downstream, which isn't the greatest idea for a water supply reservoir. As it turns out, as we saw in the five-year chart, you're in a wet period. Outdoor irrigation typically drops quite a bit. There are limitations on what the infrastructure at the dam can actually produce through the water treatment plant. And we didn't see any significant increase in use in Lopez. It actually decreased in the wet weather, even though the idea was to make the water available.
Well, I guess my point here is it looks like, in hindsight, it's always easy to discuss after. It looks like maybe the confusion has arisen by the fact that that methodology was left in place. The flood year, obviously, we passed that and continued to use that methodology. But now in an emergency situation or a drought cycle, we're finding that isn't what we want to do, and the agencies are still planning based on what's been happening for the last 4 years. So tough time to be changing it up, but that's what we're addressing here today. But I just want to reiterate, I think today we're trying to discuss what we're going to do right now for this water year to ensure that all of the Zone 3 agencies have the water that they expected, that we're not going to disrupt their water budgeting, if you will, and that they'll be able to continue on, but that we see the need to go back and address what we probably should have addressed at the end of that 2010-11 water year when the flooding ceased. We should have decided, okay, that was an exceptional decision to change it up under those specific conditions. We're not under those specific conditions, so we'll be asking to look at a long-term plan, whether it's going back to the 1988 model or something new, but that needs to be done in the future, I think, is what we're talking about. But for today, we're being asked to vote on allowing these agencies to be able to have the water they planned for under the old methodology, correct?
Correct. It's not just make all the water that's planned for available, which we're doing, or which the resolution is. Make all that planned for water available. You know, as I noted in the situation, maybe I didn't highlight, the reservoir today is at 45% capacity. So it just doesn't make sense to go straight back to the contract, mess up the planning, and leave that amount of water in the reservoir, at least for the next 12 months. Mm-hmm. We can avoid, you know, substantial financial impacts and disruption in the South County by delivering that water through this year. Mm-hmm. And avoid pumping the groundwater basin. That's what was planned for.
Right.
The physical water is there. This method of doing surplus per the contracts to avoid any legal complications, but then using the drought proclamation to get that saved water available is the recommendation.
When we talk about increased pumping, part of the problem, it's my understanding, part of the problem is not within Zone 3's purview or the county's purview. Part of the problem is arising because the adjudicated part of our county, the south end of our county, it's an adjudicated basin, and it's that excessive pumping or that part of the problem, that it is part of the problem, needs to be addressed by the court. So I'm just wondering, is that something that the county would be looking into to ensure that the court, that the compliance of the court's order is being adhered to, or how is that? Because that is a important component to correcting the excessive groundwater pumping. Am I right?
Yeah, I think we have South County agencies here, NCA member agencies, and I think they can do a better job than I could do of explaining. The results of that groundwater report and then how they're moving forward with that in the adjudication.
Okay. Yeah,
and potential any expectations for the county also.
Thank you.
Mr. Buckshaw, you have a...
Just wanted to help answer Supervisor Arnold's questions as well. And just, again, I want to go back in time here a little bit. You know, the water year for Lopez is April 1st through March 31st. So as March 31st approaches, the discussion begin about and the calculations begin about how to calculate the surplus that might be available for the coming year. What transpired in this year is that and around that time, you know, the Public Works, working as the flood control district, brought up these available, and also recognizing that this larger question of entitlement first versus surplus first is still to be discussed and up in the air, and that we can have those discussions into the future so that we, you know, have a calmer path going forward.
Thank you.
Very good. And before I turn it back to Supervisor Ray, just a quick question of my own, and I think just got answered that we are using essentially the same calculation, but on different basis, because in my reading of surplus water, that's a one-year calculation, and that water above and beyond the safe yield may accumulate behind the dam under the control of the flood control district. I take that to be the case. Correct me if I'm wrong.
That's our understanding. And there is language in the contract that specifically states that at the end of a water year, unused surplus reverts to the district, i.e., stays stored in the reservoir.
And how long, before we changed the accounting method in 2010, how long had we been operating under the previous accounting method?
There needs to be a caveat on that. As near as we can tell, from the inception of the reservoir in the late 1960s, 1970, but there was that period prior to 2010 where the water levels in the lake were held artificially low, a lot of downstream release because of the seismic issues, and the technical advisory committee recognized that counting that as surplus was just a non-starter, so the idea of even doing a surplus calculation was suspended. And then when surplus water came back in the first year, no one noticed. So the board took action then to do a one-year carryover to get last year's water up and, okay, and balance the accounts.
Your mention of downstream release was my other interest. And in terms of the downstream release, is there any requirement to release a certain amount of water downstream?
There's nothing in the contracts that requires a downstream release. That is in the contracts. It's described in the contract as simply the balance of the safe yield that isn't contracted out, the 4530. Obviously, there's natural resource and public trust doctrine issues from that. We typically operate the reservoir in a way that avoids take of endangered species and also avoids putting farmers out of water during the summer irrigation season, neither one of those by permit or regulation.
Not habitat conservation plan required?
Habitat conservation plan is ongoing.
The planning for the plan.
Yeah, there is a document that the board has adopted in Zone 3 called the Interim Downstream Release Schedule, which is a plan to keep the farmers in business, avoid violating the Endangered Species Act, and at the same time save as much water in the reservoir as possible. Okay. That dates from about 2008-09, and that's how we operate the dam.
So, and just in terms of maintaining those public trust doctrines and the viability of the water supply of downstream agricultural users, that is the responsibility of the flood control district?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you, Supervisor Ray.
That's fine. I have two questions. Well, one kind of an observation, and I just don't want it to get lost here, that to point out that oftentimes when we end up with a surplus water calculation, it's because of the savings on downstream release for whatever reason in a year, and downstream release directly affects agriculture. So what we're effectively doing sometimes, and I'm not saying this is good or bad, I'm just kind of pointing it out for purposes of discussion, is that when we're talking about the calculations for surplus water, we are often talking about that savings coming from ag and going to cities. Is that correct? Summary?
Yes, in summary, the number was there in one of the tables. Over the last 5 years, if we just add up the municipal deliveries, it's about 700 acre feet above the summary of entitlement water. And then the downstream is about 3,000 acre feet in total over 5 years below that 4,200. But again, the contract accounts for that, so it's not really taking water from downstream. It's just simply the water that was not needed to meet the natural resource and the agricultural need.
And then my question to you is, and I should have asked this in the staff report, and I just didn't realize it until you said it today because I wasn't here in 2010, that you said we changed the calculation, and when I say we, I don't even mean we. I mean it happened at the staff and the TAC level, you said. And so is the reason that nobody really noticed that didn't revert back because it never was vetted by the Board of Supervisors? Should that have been vetted by the Board of Supervisors?
That's one of those things. I talk to a lot of people about these things. I was here at the time and I didn't know this was going on. It's not part of
it. Now we're in this mess because that happened in that way. and to make sure that we don't make that mistake going forward. And I think I'm going to guess that that's what we're going to hear from the cities as we potentially renegotiate here, is so that everybody knows what's happening and it doesn't happen behind a closed door.
Oh, definitely.
Mr. Meacham?
Thank you. Mark, I want to go back more to the issue of water availability, if we can here, because you mentioned that the lake's at 45%. We don't know really what the depth right now is until we were to drop something down there to figure out what kind of infill we've had from runoff and everything else, erosion. That brings into question the amount of acre feet in the water, and it also brings into question the issue of safe yield. So I'm not quite sure how do we calculate what that lake is capable of producing if we don't know really what's there?
We know that when the dam was built,
yeah,
and all of these calculations were made about safe yield and others, that the minimum pool was set at 4,000 acre feet. And we know that relates to the capability of the delivery system. There was a bathymetric survey done to calculate safe yield as part of the HCP analysis within the last 10 years. So we know that there is water at the 4,000 foot level. It's water. We have dropped sounding instruments down to the lake to the lowest window on the intake structure, which corresponds to about 1,750 acre feet of storage, and we're concerned about the mud level at that point. But 4,000 is definitely secure, and that's what the safe yield and the contracts and everything are based on.
And what do we lose to evaporation each year?
I think in the low reservoir response plan, the consultants looked at our evaporation data, which is an actual scientific measurement taken on a regular basis, in the dry years. So the planning number is 77 inches, about
over
six and a half feet of evaporation per year.
Thanks.
Ms. Arnold.
So one more comment, because I'm anxious to hear from the cities. No matter how we define surplus or calculate it, on page 4 of 6 of our staff report, and I'm just bringing this up right now so that the cities might want to comment on this when they speak to us, but it talks, the very last paragraph, the contracts specify that surplus water that's not used in the year it's available shall revert to the district and shall not thereafter be available. The contracts don't describe how the district may or may not use this water. Therefore, the recommendation we have before us today is to, accept staff's recommendation based on an emergency drought relief water. So that's going to be a little bit different and unusual also, that we're going to be calling this water something a little bit different now, emergency drought relief water. But that just means that's the terminology we're using to just be able to just make sure this happens right now when everyone needs it, and then all of this other will be addressed during the negotiations that happen for next water year, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. With that, let us go and open it to public comment. We have a number of requests to speak on this. We'll start with Pavel Ogren, followed by Mayor Tony Ferrara.
Thank you, Board Chair, Mr. Gibson, members of the board, Pavel Ogren, General Manager, and speaking on behalf of Oceano Community Services District. Today's recommendations are supported by the OCSD Board of Directors, which held a special meeting on August 6th, resulting in support for the what is found in your draft resolution. The directors also had a follow-up at their regular meeting last week, resulting in support for the supplemental recommendations. In summary, the OCSD Board did modify over the last couple weeks their prior position. And the OCSD's board's position right now is consistent with the resolution, the current discussions at the staff level on the low reservoir response plan, the discussions at the technical advisory committee, and in preparing for the Zone 3 advisory committee meeting coming up in September. The resolution of emergency water is important to help preserve groundwater, as has been illustrated. And independent on the methodologies of calculating surplus water or talking about storage rights, If we get into start next water year in the exact same situation that we're in this year, let's say at 45 to 50% storage because we get just that right quantity of rain, we may find it again appropriate to come back next year and make a similar type of a request, which is only really possible because of the emergency declaration. The renegotiation of the contract is also important because greater certainty is needed.
Thank you, Mr. Ogren. Sure there might be a few. Mayor Ferrara, followed by Mayor Shelley Higginbotham.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. Good morning. I want you to know that after 16 years of holding public office in Arroyo Grande, I think this is the second time that I've come before the Board of Supervisors. I don't want you to internalize that or take it personally. What I try and do is stay out of your hair. And I only show up if the issue is important, and certainly this one is. I've been listening to the discussion. It's been very informative, very stimulating. I think your county administrator summed it up best. The question before us is that we certainly do want to get to the same place, but the question is how we get there. Supervisor Arnold mentioned a couple of the things that are important to us. First and foremost is the current calculation, the current methodology that we use to determine the degree of state or surplus water that we receive has been used historically over the past couple of years. It was used during this cycle as well. And from that expectation, planning assumptions were developed. In other words, and I hate to use this anecdote, now is not the time to change horses in midstream. The issue for us pretty much is summarized in, I think, our ability to continue to plan responsibly. I believe the agencies in Zone 3 have managed the groundwater basin responsibly. We want to continue to do that, and in order to do that, we have to continue to move forth with our existing planning assumptions, which are based on the current formula. That's not to say that the current formula has to stay in place forever. If there is a better way, we would certainly like to work towards that. But as has been indicated, clearly during this cycle, some of the agencies in Zone 3 and your staff are not on the same page. As such, we would be happy to work together with your staff and make sure that we do have the best formula that's available for us so that we do reach our common goals in the future. But I believe that that effort has to be done together. This is too important of an issue to be done or be handled unilaterally by county staff. We've got to move forward together. That's my main message. Consistency for this particular period of time and ensuring that if we are going to make a change, that we do it together in the future. Our county engineer and, our city engineer and our public works director are here to provide some additional detail for Arroyo Grande, so I'll close for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ferrara. Mayor Higginbotham, followed by Bob Kroll. Good
morning, Chair Gibson, board members. I could say ditto, Mayor Ferrara, but I won't. I'm here today to ask the Board of Supervisors to please look at the contract before you, contract with Zone 3. We really appreciate your time. You will see there's an attachment in your packet that is dated Thursday, July 3rd, and it is a letter from the city managers, and I think it really hits it on the head. It has concurrence with cities of Arroyo Grande, our technical committee, and our advisory committees, and letters from the city councils basically saying, please look at this contract. It needs to be renegotiated sooner than later. Decisions were made regarding past practices. You know, we truly understand there was a long history of entitlement, surplus, then it went to surplus entitlement, and that switched, and we really didn't know it was going to switch, and we made decisions based on the previous 3-4 years. And we'd like to have a little bit more transparency so that we could plan. I think Supervisors Arnold and Ray hit it right on the head saying we need to have that communication sooner than later. I know that Mr. Buckshy and his staff have been coming to meet with the cities and trying to get some sort of agreement, but we really need to have this done sooner than later because those decisions are made early in the year. So I appreciate your time and attention in this. We do have staffs from all of the cities available to answer any questions, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Higginbotham. Mr. Perrault, followed by Jim Gehring.
Bob Perrault, City Manager, City of Grover Beach. And to echo what has already been said, I would like, first of all, to say that the City of Grover Beach appreciates the recommendation in terms of the allocation of 2,327 acre feet. It's badly needed in order to allow us to continue to manage the water resources between the basin and the lake effectively. Where the managers met with public works staff. At that time, we talked about the future of the lake and what was going to be needed and that there was going to need to be a lower release plan. During that process, it was projected that, yeah, we knew we had 3 or 4 years left of water capacity in the lake, but there was no discussion at that point of having to change surplus methodology. And as far as we knew, it was going to remain in place. That followed with the continued reports and communications we had on Zone 3 that reflected we were using surplus, not using entitlement, and therefore that unused entitlement rolled over to surplus. And that's how we had seen that interpretation come through, and we felt that that was the appropriate way to go. So that concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Perrault. Mr. Gehring, followed by Ben Fine.
Chairman and members of the board, good morning. My name is Jim Gehring, and I hold a number of engineering positions on the in the South County, city engineer of Roy Grandy, water sewer engineer for Grover Beach, and engineer for the South County Sanitation District. But I think the important position I've held for the longest is that I've been on the Zone 3 Advisory Committee now for 33 years so far. And I'm surprised to find that in your board packet, there is not the written detailed recommendation from the Zone 3 Advisory Committee. You should know that that committee does not operate in a vacuum. We have a technical advisory committee that is composed of technical members from the various agencies and from the county, including operational people from the water treatment plant. And that technical advisory committee meets twice before the Zone 3 Advisory Committee meets and makes recommendations to the Zone 3 Advisory Committee. So the Zone 3 recommendations are detailed and extensive, and yet I believe they're not in your packet. So let me summarize for you. The Zone 3 Advisory Committee recommends that you declare 2,327 acre feet of surplus water using the current methodology. That is the methodology that's been in force since 2011. And that you direct staff to work with us on contract languages, changes that are necessary to make things more clear, and let us utilize our water supplies in a more effective manner. Those recommendations basically are mirrored in the three letters you received from the city managers. So if you read those three letters, you'll have a good idea of what the Zone 3 Advisory Committee recommended to you. And just as an aside, after 33 years on the committee, I think the board should consider whether it needs to direct staff that Zone 3 recommendations or all any of your other committee recommendations get presented to you in the detail instead of filtered through staff, because they're different, particularly in this case. You might gain the the impression from the staff report that the agencies have been using more water than they're entitled to under the contracts. That's absolutely untrue. Your board and the Director of Public Works has declared surplus every year except this year and those years when we didn't have surplus since 1970. The agencies have stayed within their entitlements and the declared surplus for that entire period. The recommendation of the Zone 3 Advisory Committee that's before you today for the 2,327 acre feet, if you use the methodology that's been in place for the last 3 years, you get 2,327 acre feet. It's within the safe yield of the reservoir, and it's according to the recommendation of the Zone 3 Advisory Committee. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer questions if you like.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Mr. Fine, followed by Jeff English.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, honorable members of the board. My name is Ben Fine. I'm the Director of Public Works and the City Engineer for the City of Pismo Beach, and I'm speaking on behalf of the city and as a member agency of Zone 3. The recommendation made by your staff does achieve our goal of delivering the water from the Lopez Reservoir that we and the other zone agencies believe we're entitled to. However, the calculation of surplus water, as you've heard, is contrary to the way it's been done in the past. Further, it's in contradiction to the records of the way that water was delivered last year, and that's the way that we planned our water use strategies for this year. So if you look at the records, it'll show you from last year that the Zone 3 agencies were delivered surplus water first and then our entitlement. Changing the methodology after the water is used makes it very hard for member agencies to constructively plan their water use strategies, and more critically, it puts us in a really tough situation. It's really risky. Should the board direct, what we would like to see is that the board directs staff to renegotiate certain elements of the contract. Mr. Buckshy earlier said, and I appreciate him meeting and his staff meeting with us, that the agencies wanted to continue using this methodology. We have suggested that the groundwater basin levels drop significantly at that time when we all turned on our pumps. So, in conclusion, we look forward to working with the county and the county staff on renegotiating key elements of the contract so that in the future there's not a delay in the declaration of surplus water and that we don't end up here again in the future trying to figure out how we're going to use our water. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Fine. Mr. English, followed by Brian Talley.
Chairperson Gibson, members of the board, appreciate the opportunity to speak on this item. Obviously, from the city of Rio Grande, this is a very critical issue. We represent 50% of the deliveries to municipal agencies from the reservoir. So it is a critical issue for us. It is our preference to work through the board and not through the county staff and not necessarily approach the board directly. And we agree with the recommendation to declare surplus this year. However, we disagree with the methodology, the change in the rules midstream, and really the unilateral nature in which that negotiation or lack of negotiation happened this year. As I mentioned, surplus carryover water is a critical planning tool for us that we had planned on this year. Advanced planning is necessary for us in our use of our water resources, and as early as or as late as April of this year, and I have it in my hand, we received a calculation from county staff that calculated the deliveries at 2142, and that was April of this year. April is the start of the water year, so that's a little late in the game to change the rules for us. Also, I just want to emphasize that the emergency water declaration that is proposed and the use of this emergency water, my understanding is that it is water from San Luis Reservoir. There was a question, I believe, posed by Chairperson Gibson about the amount of evaporation from the lake each year. In discussions with Jim Gehring, who has a little history on this, it's about 1,500 acre-feet of water that is evaporated from the lake each year. The water that is in San Luis Reservoir is not evaporating. We have that amount, and that amount will stay the same. That is available to us in future years. We're concerned about an immediate use of water this year, and that it's prudent to use the surplus water as calculated previously for this year. We do recognize the need for some changes in the methodology and some contract changes, and we're absolutely willing to participate and see the need for those changes. And in fact, the low reservoir release plan this year is not anticipated based on staff's calculations that we received in the most recent package. It's not anticipated that we're even going to reach the current low reservoir release plan of 20,000 acre feet this year. So we are not in a position where we need to make a critical decision to change the plans in midstream. So we recommend, again, that you use the current methodology this year and direct staff to enter into negotiations with Zone 3 staff and the TAC in order to make those appropriate changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. English. Mr. Talley.
Hi there. I'm Brian Talley, resident of Arroyo Grande, and here today as the agricultural representative of Zone 3. And I guess the first thing I'd like to do is really reiterate some of the things that Jim Gehring said. I've had the pleasure of serving with him for, I think, probably about 15 years on the Zone 3 Advisory Committee. It's a very, very effective group. I guess I'm a little dismayed to hear that the recommendations that apparently came from Zone 3 apparently weren't in the board packet. I didn't happen to see that, but I'm going to take Jim's word for that. And the other thing I'd like to say is that it probably is appropriate to consider some changes in the way that Lopez Dam, Lopez Lake, the water system is operated, but all of that needs to go through Zone 3 because that's where agriculture has our voice, and agriculture is obviously an important part of what's going on in the South County. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Talley. That was our last request to speak, so I will close it to public comment and bring it back to the board. Supervisor Ray.
Well, that was a perfect segue. I didn't realize that Mr. Talley was going to get to go last, so I'm going to kind of piggyback off what he just said. I think a couple things. I think some of the breakdown in communication between Zone 3 and the county comes from how they plan for water usage. And having sat on both sides of the fence here, I asked a question of county staff a couple of months ago, and I was very important for us to direct. The one concern that I have is, you know, we got the I'll call it the supplemental demands, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but we received on Friday last week a list of five things that refer to what Mr. Gehring was talking about that Zone 3 had asked for but did not appear to be in the staff report. So I wanted to go through those five things real quickly and just make sure that we're all on the same page. The first one asks us to acknowledge that there is a difference in opinion on how we're calculating this. And I think we are all in agreement. Obviously, there is a difference of opinion. This is not the county saying we know and you don't. The second one is that whatever we decide today with regard with the release of the 2,300 acre feet of water, that this is a one-year only thing. We're not setting precedent going on into the next year. And so if we all agree to that, I think that's fine. The one I am concerned about is C, which specifically says to enter into negotiations with Zone 3 member agencies. And I think that we need to make sure that we enter in with the Zone 3 Advisory Committee, which is different than the member agencies because the way that this is worded, it specifically excludes ag. So anything that we decide or direct here at the board today needs to be redirected back to the Zone 3 Advisory Committee as a matter of process because then all those member agencies and the at-large members and ag get their voice there. They hammer that out. We don't. It doesn't make sense to negotiate that here without the full participation of Zone 3. D asks for a return to the board by a date certain. I would just change that to a date uncertain based on the fact that we need to go back through Zone 3, but definitely have that come back to us. And then lastly, they ask for a review of flood control district's budget. I would just soften that one a little bit and just say that we need to take a look at groundwater monitoring equipment and studies, and the Zone 3 group is asking for that to relate to NCMA. I don't think we can do that to the exclusion of NMMA because these are two managed basin or two parts of the basin that are not exclusive of each other. So if the flood control district, as controlled here, has to look at the Santa Maria groundwater basin, at least the part that's in San Luis County, if we're going to look at groundwater management studies, we have to do both NCMA and NMMA. We can do that later on. We don't have to direct that at this moment, but I think that's the direction this board has been going all along, at least since I've been sitting here. I've been fighting for this since the first day I got here. So I guess in summary, that I think we can add all five of the things that the municipalities are asking for as long as every one of them gets vetted through Zone 3 first and that the specificity of C is reduced to enter into negotiation with the Zone 3 Advisory Committee.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Ray. Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am supportive of Supervisor Ray's comments that reiterate essentially the letter with some changes that we did receive. And I think that, you know, we're pretty much in agreement on everything, or I hope that our board is pretty much in agreement. There may be an existing semantic disagreement right now, which is neither wet nor dry when it comes to semantics. So I think we can do as we've heard from our cities in terms of sticking with the current calculation and then getting into the negotiations about going forward, because it's in everybody's interest to make sure that we don't run Lopez dry. It's also in everybody's interest that we don't run the groundwater dry, and we don't want to do anything that might favor any of one agencies over the others. You know, the only concerns that I have is both Grover and AG have only two sources, and that has to be taken into account in any negotiations going forward, including some of the recommendations we've seen on banking as well. We don't want to see somebody at the at the mercy of another agency that has more sources of water, especially in this time. So hoping that we can move forward and staff can work out whatever differences exist, which I'm confident they can. And I think this. I know the cities have done a great job on their conservation efforts, and that's certainly to their credit. So hopefully we'll be able to make the motions soon.
Ms. Arnold.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you all for being here and helping us talk this out. Mr. Fine brought up something that I had discussed with staff earlier this week, and that was creating some kind of a trigger, a reservoir level trigger for future years, so that whatever's hammered out in the contract negotiations has the flexibility to adjust for flood years, drought years, and everything in between. And then it sounds like storage rights, all the agencies for later, longer than.
Right. And that's something we discussed last week. And we will be discussing with all of the state water subcontractors is the issue of whether or not, as staff is suggesting, we should move that state water into the county next year and not risk losing it to a shutdown of the system should the drought continue. Okay. But this 23-27 is all Lopez water.
Okay. And then my last question, I think for us today, you know, I think it sounds like everyone, we have an agreement on the ability to deliver the 27 acre feet of water this year. And it's boiling down. I heard everyone that spoke, almost everyone, talk about using the current methodology this year. So I think what I'm missing is understanding what difference that makes. It must have a difference with carryover. It must have a difference into next year, the way we are labeling that water that we're about to deliver.
That's an important consideration. If we use the surplus first, then entitlement, then we could say that when we get to April 1st next year, any part of the 23-27 that didn't go out would be entitlement, and by definition is surplus for next year. So there's that assurity. Our recommendation is to stay with the emergency drought relief water, gives the board flexibility, doesn't raise any contract legality complications. But important to understand, I think the board understands, that using the drought proclamation and the term emergency drought relief water does set a precedent, and hopefully one that the South County Agency Zone 3 can rely on to get us through this drought.
So the precedent we set is just that in extreme conditions, whatever, if we're going flood, if we're going drought, but in extreme conditions, we would be, this kind of a situation would reoccur. We would kind of hash it out as needed, and it gives us a separate category to be functioning under, this emergency.
It does,
third
definitely.
Level. So there we go. So that, I think, for me is the key of this whole day. We're talking about understanding that we were changing horses in midstream or whatever, or that the county, I mean, I think I feel a little bit sad that the confusion is happening in the middle of a really important time for all these agencies to do their planning and be able to serve their customers. And there are customers, too, so I'm not forgetting that. But what they're trying to tell us, I think, is they planned a certain way because they were never told the methodology is going to change. So how important is that continuing planning? In other words, we're going to talk, we're going to give them the water this year that they're entitled to, but now it goes beyond that, I believe, and that is whatever is their ability to put in their savings account part of that 23-27 or know where it is or what the status of it is. So they obviously are planning into next year as well, and that is what might change. That's their concern here, correct?
Yeah, if I may address that to Supervisor Arnold, I think that's the concern. I think the way that could be addressed, depending on the direction your board wants to head, is that obviously there has been considerable interest in opening these contracts for discussion and renegotiation, and depending upon the outcome of those negotiations, that's where that longer-term assurance would come from.
Yeah. I understand that, and I feel like if in the spirit of not changing on them right now, whatever I'm not even sure because I haven't discussed it with anybody, what that 23-27 entitlement versus surplus, how much they're going to use, we don't know what's going to be left, et cetera. So not even going there, just on the principle that they planned, and it's as stressful a time for the agencies as it is for the county. They planned on, or their water budget has been based on a certain methodology, and for us to change it up, I don't know. I didn't hear. I heard from almost every agency that they want to continue to use the methodology as well as that allotment. Or they need to count on that. I didn't hear why or what their plans were to do with that. But in the spirit of not changing it up on them this year, so I guess then one more question, if I might, is how much would that affect the county's plans in managing the reservoir if we stayed with the methodology? The 23-27 went out, and some of that then, part of that, we don't know how much, would be labeled surplus or whatever next year? Or does the new negotiations... What's hard to wrap my head around is that this whole thing was changed up with a policy decision.
Let me clarify kind of the approach that county staff had taken for this current year. In my mind, 23-27 is 23-27.
Give them their 23-27. If we agree to give them that today under the existing methodology, in other words, I do believe I'm hearing in the spirit of not pulling the rug out from under them, and they have a plan where some of that's being saved, will that we would renegotiate that away in negotiating for going and beyond, or someone could step up and talk about why.
Actually, if we might, we have a couple other lights on, and we can get to further comments from the cities if we want. But let me see if I could help this process. I think it's appropriate that we move forward with staff's recommendations today with direction that's based on the supplemental recommendations that Supervisor Ray walks us through. It meets the needs of the member jurisdictions of Zone 3. It's exactly the same amount of water that they're requesting. It does not disrupt their current planning. It also sets us up for a future which is more certain, at least more clear, if not more certain, certainty being based on how much rainfall we get. So the way I look at it is all the water that accumulates behind Lopez Dam is to be used for the benefit of the member jurisdictions of Zone 3. It's not going anywhere else. Right now, the way the contract is written and the way that we have administered that contract, save for the last couple of years, the Flood Control District manages those waters that are above and beyond the entitlement and the so-called surplus, which is a one-year deal. And you're seeing us manage that for the benefit of Zone 3 by declaring it emergency. We have understanding that it's a drought emergency. We are declaring that water to be distributed for the benefit of Zone 3. All the jurisdictions here spoke to the need to renegotiate the contract, and I agree with that completely. The way I envision it is that those member jurisdictions need to come up with an agreement among all of them. And you heard from the cities, but you also heard from the Oceano CSD, which is in support of the basis upon which we're moving forward. So clearly there's some difference, potentially, differences of opinion within the member jurisdictions. The county is one of those within Zone 3. I'm all for making the water available in exactly the amount based on the resolution we have in our packet, getting immediately into the negotiations that will be between the flood control district, the county, the cities, the Oceano CSD, to get this settled. And if they want to go to a model that's more like Whale Rock Reservoir, where we keep individual savings accounts of how much water is due each agency held behind that dam, that's fine. But all those entities have to agree. And I think that we get where we need to go very simply by moving forward with what's in our packet today. The one thing that I would note, again, those five recommendations, it might be helpful to get them back up. I would point out to Supervisor Ray that the negotiations, the parties to the contract are actually the jurisdictions and members agency.
More than that.
Well, the role of the Zone 3 Advisory Committee is just that, extremely important, and I would certainly expect that they would be consulted on all of this. But, again, the negotiations on amending the contract are with the jurisdictions. I agree with you. We should not set a date certain to bring this back. And I think that, again, in Recommendation E, we want a more general direction to look at what we need to do to manage all the water resources of the South County. And with that, I'll yield the floor to Supervisor Ray, unless Supervisor Arnold, you had anything more.
Maybe I could address my questions after Supervisor Ray.
Okay, we'll be right back then.
I want to be crystal clear here, because from the county's point of view, and it's been set up here, and I'm not sure it's correct, 2327 is 2327. However, I want to be crystal clear that on April 1st, is there a difference from an accounting perspective between what benefits Zone 3 and the member agencies when the new water year begins? If we say surplus water on the old calculation or the new calculation that is being recommended today, what is the difference on April 1 of 2015?
If we use the, I'll call it the traditional calculation method, and go through this year, we could end up with part of the 23-27 not delivered. And my goodness, even backing up.
Don't back up. Just make it
well,
simple.
Some of the water not delivered. And okay. Under the traditional calculation based on pushing, then there would be zero surplus generated from the contracts and some from downstream. And that's why we need to understand that if we find ourselves in a drought situation, low reservoir.
I don't have to worry about what you just said, because that's going to get hammered out before that time. So we will already have that if we are in the situation where whatever carryover water would happen in the 15-16 water year was more than would get us below the 20,000 mm-hmm. acre feet, that low reservoir response plan already kicks in. We will have done that already.
Yes.
So that worry is kind of a false worry right now.
Yes.
Okay. So here, I know that Supervisor Meacham has questions, so I will yield the floor to him because I am ready to make a motion.
I have questions too.
Yeah. And Supervisor Meacham, then Ms. Arnold.
Okay, I'm supportive of Supervisor Ray's suggestions. I do like the idea of in the negotiation aspect of it, the trigger points that was suggested. I think that might be a good way to go. But as far as planning is concerned, and I understand Supervisor Arnold's concern about cities trying to plan. I was with a city. I understand all that. This is a changing situation every single week, it seems as though, as we're going through this water issue. There may be some significant changes that will have to be made as we progress. I hope not, but they very well could be. So I don't want to get locked into a time that we're going to have to say, yes, you're going to get this, you're going to get this, and it's not there. So I'm in favor of opening the negotiation to talk about this, but go forward with the amount that's being requested right now.
Ms. Arnold?
Quick question to Mark. The low reservoir plan triggers it at 2027, 20 acre feet?
Is that 20,000 acre feet 20,000 as measured on April 1st.
Correct. So that's your safety net. When it gets there, all bets are off and things change some way, or you're negotiating how. So we have that safety net. We will after we adopt this, it sounds like. So then I would like to go back, Mr. Chair, when you talked about the methodology does not disrupt the current plan, that's what I'm not sure about. So I'd like to ask someone. I saw Mr. Fine step up like he would be willing to answer, but someone from the agencies, does the methodology we're using right now disrupt your current planning? And if so, how?
Take Mr. Fine and Mr. Ogram.
Penn Fine, City of Pismo Beach. So I'll go back to what Mrs. Ray asked, is what's the implication on August 1st, or on April 1st? And the difference is if we stick with the old methodology or the methodology that was used last year, there's a potential that we will have surplus water again next year. Whereas if we go with staff's recommendation of 501 acre feet surplus plus this emergency water, there's no possibility of surplus water for next year. And that's kind of what goes into our water planning. When we plan our water use, we look at what are we going to get for our entitlement, what are we going to get for our anticipated surplus next year, and we kind of make our water use, what are we going to use? Are we going to use state water? Are we going to use Lopez water? Are we going to use surplus water to try to benefit not necessarily next year, but the year after that? And so that's, I hope, answers your question. And
it does. So bottom line is you were planning on some ability to have surplus water next year.
That's correct.
You were hoping.
Mr. Ogren, you wanted to comment on this?
Certainly do. Pablo Ogren, Oceano Community Services District again. What might occur or might not occur on April 1st is certainly going to depend on what kind of rain we might get. I think that the importance of the resolution and exactly what's been forwarded to you from your staff and from your legal counsel is contract compliance. To the extent that others have spoken that over the last couple years there was a modification of the methodology and that was done at a staff level, that's a completely different situation than for your board to take an action that is in contrast to the contract language. And if you were to do that, to award all of that water underneath the supplemental water notion, then the argument would be that it would put Oceano CSD in a disadvantage in upcoming negotiations, and we would have no choice but to dispute the contractual compliance with that determination. This issue has been well vetted by your legal counsel. Your staff has provided the recommendations in order to get through emergency provisions all of the water that the agencies are asking for. And if we have a repeat of next year of what we're looking at this year, certainly there is the confidence that your board would take a similar action next year in providing emergency water. I do not think that there's a reason to get into a contractual dispute. And I think it's important that you follow your legal counsel and your staff's recommendations on the resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Ogren. Ms. Ray?
Let's have legal weigh in on this real quick.
Rita Neal, County Council. We have spent a great deal of time looking at this contract, as you might imagine, and I think Mr. Ogren does bring up an important point. The contract doesn't speak specifically to the methodology that should be used, but when you read the contract as a whole, you start with Article 4, which talks about the priority for the distribution that would serve us best moving forward, and I think serve us best for negotiations for all the entities involved.
So if we were to go with continuing, if we were going to go forward with continuing the formula as has been used last year and the year prior, do we have any sort of de facto obligation to continue with that? Even though it wasn't made at the board decision level, there was an expectation based on past practice.
Sure. And that will be an argument if we have to get into arguing about what the contract says, what is the expectation. I suppose the counter-argument is the expectation is for at least 40 years we used another methodology, and I think it was in 1988 that the board confirmed that methodology that we were using. So at a staff level, unfortunately, a decision was made, but now we're trying to correct that.
Okay. Well, my concern...
Do you have a? I'm sorry. Do you have a motion? I didn't.
Yes.
Didn't mean to step on it.
My concern, my original thought was to go back to the regular calculation, but my concern is setting up a legal issue. And what I really want to have happen is I want the cities to be protected. I want ag to be protected. I want everybody sitting at the table, not just the municipalities, but ag as well. And so that is what my motion is going to move around. Would you please put on the board the 5 supplemental recommendations? Thank you. So I would like to move that we accept staff's recommendations with these additional 5 modified as such. That we simply say to acknowledge there continues to be a difference of opinion between the county and some of the Zone 3 member agencies, period. That's it. That's fine the way it is, that this is for this year only. C, to enter into negotiations with the Zone 3 Advisory Committee, period. And D, to return to the board without a date certain with a status report on negotiations. And E, I'm going to reword this a little bit. To have the flood control district review possible funding available for groundwater monitoring and equipment and studies in both NCMA, Northern Cities Management Area, and NMMA, Napomo Mesa Management Area.
I'll second that.
Second, and we have a motion. Supervisor Ray seconded Supervisor Hill. Under discussion, Supervisor Arnold.
Well, I'm still concerned that the methodology was our variation. So the fact that we are trying to do our best to not interrupt what the agencies in the middle of a serious drought have budgeted with their water, it sounds like if we don't continue along the same methodology they were planning on for this year, that we are going to disrupt them. So and I'll try one more time to just confirm this. If the reservoir level gets to 20,000 feet, then surplus water, all that goes away anyway, correct? That's an emergency trigger that we stop, or that stops entitlements of surplus or entitled water, whatever we've described.
Yeah, let me clarify that. Mm-hmm. The draft LRRP suspends the whole surplus thing.
Okay.
But the final LRRP may have additional language that describes how to apply that. And get into the details of it. So it's not necessarily to say at this point,
okay,
no surplus.
It's, but
however,
it is
the LRRP.
In good faith with all the agencies that we know there may come a time when all bets are off, everything's suspended because
The work of the Technical Advisory Committee, county staff, NCMA on the LRRP is just excellent.
Okay.
Absolutely excellent.
So with that, I am still feeling like, it was our variance from the original contract that kind of created this misunderstanding, and in an attempt to respond in good faith, I feel like we need to accept all of staff's recommendation except for, where are my words here, except for use the existing contract methodology this last water year, just this year.
Okay. Thank you.
I would like to add a little something in that I neglected to add into the recommendations. I want to add F to this. So before we go too much further so that people can discuss.
Okay.
F, I want to make sure that any changes in calculations come to a board decision and are not done at the staff level in the future, and hopefully the second will hold on that.
We do. Let me just ask a clarifying question of you, Ms. Ray, if I might, and that is on your advisory committee. In the end, we're not, if we renegotiate the contract, we're not negotiating with the advisory committee. We're negotiating with the member jurisdictions. Consulting the advisory committee is obviously a very good idea. And so that I was just going to clarify for staff's benefit that that's what we want to move forward on.
I'm not sure, and I need to ask legal about this because, again, I want to make sure that ag's voice is not lost in these negotiations.
Right. And that's,
and so it, yeah. Do they have an official voice as a beneficiary of the contract?
Rita Neal County Council, and I think that's where the confusion is coming. Under the contract, there's downstream releases. Mm-hmm. Now, as Mr. Hutchinson said early in his presentation, they aren't, ag isn't a party to the contract, nor are, you know, the environmental concerns or groups. But we, the county or the district, have obligations as to the downstream releases. So whether you call it an interested party or real party in interest, certainly the ag has an interest in the downstream releases. The signatories to the contract itself will just be the agencies. So I'm trying to figure out how...
What's the best wording then?
I think probably the best wording is to, we would certainly negotiate final contract terms with the agencies, but the process should be that negotiations, updates on negotiations involve the advisory committee. And we can maybe work on that wording a little bit.
What she said.
And just in terms of clarifying that, again, let me turn to the second and Mr. Buchanan.
Yeah, and I kind of going along with your point, I don't think we've ever been in contract negotiations with an advisory group. We have to, as you mentioned, consult. They do need to weigh in and give their advice to the member agencies, the ones in which are going to be negotiating the contract final.
So it, maybe the wording can be to enter negotiations with the member agencies with close consultation with the advisory committee in order to protect the interests that are involved, all interests impacted by the contract.
Perfect.
All right. So we're good on that. And with no further discussion or questions? Or
I have questions.
Yes.
The motion that you made, Supervisor Ray, was the A through F. You added F.
Yes.
Yes.
But then are you...
And staff's recommendation.
And staff's recommendation, but yes. Not including using the existing contract methodology.
Correct.
Okay.
And with that, then, Madam Clerk, if you're clear on the motion, we would take a roll call vote, please.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
No.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you all very much. We're going to take a 10-minute break, reconvene at high noon for the last item of the morning. Thank you, Madam Clerk. We are back, and if you would please introduce our next item.
Item number 10, a hearing to adopt an ordinance regulating outdoor water use to Mondays and Thursdays within applicable county service areas 10A Cayucas, 16 Shandon, 23 Santa Margarita, and 12 Avila Valley, in accordance with the Drought Emergency Water Conservation Regulations adopted by the State Water Resources Board, and finding that the project is exempt from Section 21000 of the California Resources Code, California Environmental Quality Act, Districts 1, 2, 3, and 5.
Very good. Mr. Benedict, Ms. Montez, welcome.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Supervisors. Dean Benedict, Utilities Division Manager. I'm here with Andrea Montes, our Program Manager. And we have a very brief PowerPoint to summarize to you our recommendation for outdoor watering ordinances for the four county service areas that the county manages. The county, as a public water supplier, is required to be instituting conservation measures as directed by an emergency ordinance from the State Water Resources Control Board. The State Board came out with these directives to reduce water, and basically their target is a 20% reduction overall. They also had four specific prohibitions for all Californians to reduce wasting water using outside. We're not going to address those today. Today is on the ordinance, and I'll turn it over to Andrea, who will go through a brief presentation.
Ms. Montes.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, members of the board. On July 15th, the State Water Resources Control Board adopted emergency regulations to ensure water agencies, their customers, and state residents increase water conservation. The State Water Resources Control Board implemented some regulations, which include no watering of outdoor landscapes that cause runoff, no using hoses without shut-off nozzles, using water in a fountain or decorative water feature unless the water is... So on August 12th, we came to you with the emergency ordinance to have it introduced. Today we are asking the Board of Supervisors to take action to adopt this emergency ordinance. And shall this emergency ordinance be adopted, it will take effect August 27th, bringing the county into compliance with the State Water Resources Control Board's regulations and will assist with efforts to ensure water conservation. So last week we began to distribute public outreach information, one of them being a mailer that was sent to all residents within CSA 10A, 16, 23, and CSA 12. In addition to the mailers, we'll be placing billboards, and these billboards should be placed within the next 2 weeks or so within the same CSAs. And I should note that in addition to the mailers and these billboards, Public Works staff did attend advisory committee meetings within the last couple of weeks, so we informed these communities of the ordinance that we were proposing. So the way that we'd like to implement this ordinance is through education, encouragement, and then enforcement. This is an example of a door hanger that would be placed as part of our encouragement efforts, and it would be noting any violations to the state regulations in addition to the county ordinance. And these door hangers would only be placed if our field operations staff witness what they believe to be a violation. So for more information, you could visit slocountywater.org in addition to the State Water Resources Control's website. And the county has implemented a water conservation and drought hotline that went live last week, and that number is 781-4466. And this concludes the presentation. We're available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Montes. I saw council's light on. Was there something to add here to the?
Yes, Reed and Neal County Council. I just wanted to clarify for particularly the public that might be listening, the regulations that were put in place by the state were emergency regulations. What you're being asked today is to pass an ordinance, which will go. It's not an urgency ordinance. It is an ordinance which will go in effect 30 days from today if you pass the ordinance, and that's what the ordinance and the resolution before you says today. So 30 days from today would be effective.
All right, very good, Mr. Meacham.
Thank you. And Ms. Neal, when would it be lifted?
Erica Stuckey, Deputy County Counsel. It would be lifted when the State Water Board regulations expire.
Expire. Okay, thank you. The unfortunate thing of it is that some of our CSAs, they don't use that much water. Some of them are really down there, and now to take another 20% is going to be really tough for them to accomplish that, especially when I'm getting phone calls from some that are on the borders. Somebody's doing overhead irrigation right next door to them, and they get away with doing whatever they want. And so I think it's an unfair burden, but by the same token, I see the necessity to try to accomplish this.
Ms. Arnold?
I had some of the same concerns, and when our Public Works first brought this to me, I thought, oh, well, if the State Water Resource Board is going to implement an emergency or require this emergency ordinance to try to reduce water usage by 20%, there's a lot of ways to do that that give people choices. In other words, some people may love their yard. They want to spend their water allotment fixing their yard and eat off paper plates. Some people would rather just let their yard go. And anyway, so it's important to me to try to work with folks so that they can choose how they want to come up with that water savings. Another concern I had is Mondays and Thursdays. We have our weekend gardeners that then would be allowed to really water their yard during the weekends. But after talking to staff, we talked about this being a temporary ordinance, and I believe, and maybe Erica can help me, I read that the state emergency resolution is 240 days, I think, but I'm just not sure what date that started.
I believe it's 270 days.
That's correct.
270. And it starts 30 days from the date it was enrolled, which was July 28th.
So it starts July 28th and goes for 260.
The state water board regulations.
And after that, we're not obligated. I mean, they would revisit, and then we could revisit. So I think that we could have a certain – I don't have my calendar, but we could have a sunset date that matches the state's.
The way it's written now is that it's in effect for as long as the state water board regulations are in effect. So if the state water board regulations expire – or when they expire, the ordinance will also expire.
What about that 270-day?
All right. Any further questions? Seeing none, I'll open it to the public. I have no request to speak, and seeing no one coming forward, we'll bring it back to the board for action.
I have one more ask here. when you talked about the door hangers and the fines,
yes,
go along with the door hangers, I would wish to put a first warning before we...
We're actually looking at three warnings.
Three warnings.
Yes.
Very good.
And like I said, it would be, you know, education and encouragement first.
Perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll move staff recommendation.
Second. And we'll take Mr. Meacham's second. Under discussion, slightly off topic, our CSAs do, you know, purvey water for indoor use as well. And some of the... community services districts, the cities have stepped up through drought, you know, various levels of drought response, adding significant surcharges for amounts over a certain. Now, we are pretty efficient in our use within most of these CSAs, but has there been any consideration separately, this is a topic separate from what we're considering today, about instituting tiered water rates that would encourage indoor conservation as well?
Yes, we do have tiered water rates now. Depending on the response we get, and Supervisor Meacham basically noted that we have pretty low water use for these areas. We're going to be looking at that in the future to see if that would support additional and appropriate conservation.
Very good. All right. With that, have a staff line.
The motion waives the reading.
Yes.
Motion waives the reading. Motion maker in the second.
It's my understanding the ordinance that was presented got changed.
No.
It got amended.
There was a clerical error. I think some of our lettering was mislettered. Duplicated F and G, I believe.
Yeah, there were two F and Gs. It's been corrected.
Fine. Wow. I'm not. No. I'm not going there, but.
Everybody was thinking it.
Good. With that, and the clerk has those corrections regarding letter F and letter G.
Hold on, wait. Oh, okay. Yes. I see it.
She got it.
Yes. Okay.
With that,
Supervisor
roll call.
Mr. Hill.
Yes.
Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray.
Yes.
Ms. Arnold.
Yes.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes. Thank you. We come then to closed session. I have no request to speak. No one coming forward. I will close it to the public on closed session. Council?
Rita Neal, County Council, about 35 to 40 minutes today.
And we will be back
at 1:30.
Wow. I don't know, ladies and gentlemen, the power of the clerk is awesome. As she reached over to turn on the microphones, the happy noises and laughter died down. She has brought this room to attention and order, and we will start our afternoon session, as we often do, by hearing from our esteemed counsel as regards the results of closed session.
Rita Neal, County Council. The board did meet in closed session, and no reportable action was taken.
Consistent with my recollection of the event. With that, we come to our presentation calendar. This is actually a presentation that is being made from the San Luis Coastal Resource Conservation District to PG&E. And the board is pleased to provide some space to hear about a very interesting project and invite Dr. Neil Havlick, representing the RCD, to the lectern to introduce this item for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greetings, members of the Board of Supervisors. Again, my name is Neil Havlick, and I'm the president of the Board of Directors of the Coastal San Luis Resource Conservation District. Over the past years, the RCD has honored various groups and individuals who, in our judgment, have provided particularly valuable examples of agricultural or environmental stewardship in our area. It's our pleasure, therefore, to honor the team of workers at the local office of Pacific Gas and Electric Company who carried out the replacement, or reconductoring, as it's called, of the high-voltage transmission lines between San Luis Obispo and Atascadero in 2012 and 2013. This large project passed through some very sensitive lands, especially the city of San Luis Obispo's Reservoir Canyon Natural Reserve, which is noted for its serpentine rocks and soils, numerous rare plant species, and great wildflower displays, as well as having important wildlife habitat. When I first learned about the project, I worked for the city at the time, I was worried that it would be impractical to undertake the replacement of the numerous towers along this way without significant environmental damage to this sensitive area, and I expressed those concerns to the project managers. I have to say this of the year for 2013, and I think there's John from PG&E has something to say, and then we have a little plaque to award the company with. Thank you.
Mr. Scholz or Mr. Daniels? Right.
Good afternoon, Chairman Gibson and members of the boards. It's always great to see everyone. And we just want to thank Dr. Neil Havlick. Neil and I go way back when we both worked for the city of San Luis Obispo. And I know he is a man of integrity, and this award really means a lot to us. Jackie Krebs as well. So what I'd like to do is just kind of take you through why we did this project and how we were able to do this project with such a small footprint. As a matter of fact, it may take more time for me to do this presentation than it took for the helicopters to come out and pour a footing. But anyway, so Eric, why don't you go ahead and I do want to acknowledge some of the folks who are with us today. I've got Craig Gertard, who is our environmental manager, Chris Alvardis, who is a senior land planner, as well as Sally Crin, who is a terrestrial biologist out of Diablo Canyon. And then I want to acknowledge Lee Ellis, who is a senior project manager who I know negotiated with Neil when we first started this project. So why did we do this project? It's a 16-mile stretch of the 70 kV transmission line from Atascadero to San Luis Obispo. And quite simply, the equipment was aging. We did this because to include a thicker conductor to reduce outage frequency, to decrease resistance, and then to lessen degradation from climatic conditions. We replaced over 140 wooden poles because those poles had caught in fire over the years, as well as replacing 40-plus steel towers, which were not heavy enough or could not support the heavier conductor. So the project started in May 2011 and was completed in September 2013. And so construction methods were utilized to minimize the impact on the environment. And here's a helicopter that is bringing the tower to the site. We actually staged out of our facility over on Johnson Avenue in San Luis Obispo. Next one. In addition to the helicopters, basically the tower footings were hand-dug. We had hike and fly-in only sites, and we utilized existing roads to the maximum extent feasible, and we also minimized road improvements, trying to keep the work area to a minimum. Environmental measures that were taken, we talked about some sensitive species protection, minimizing impacts in sensitive habitat in the city open space, which is what Neil talked about. And then we rescheduled work to avoid nesting birds and then identified exclusion zones. And as this was all going on, there was some monitoring going on with respect to the measures that were put in place. So through our construction methods, we prioritized and said we're going to do it the avoidance and minimization. And then there was quite a few surveys. A lot of work was done, pre-construction surveys and monitoring. And Chris can talk to those in a lot of more detail if you are interested in that. This is just a photo showing some of the erosion control that was done on steep slopes. So some of the temporary and permanent erosion control. This is the crew that's working up there. And you can see that basically doing it in a sensitive manner by buckets and just a little teamwork going on there. Next slide. A lot of site restoration on the property. You know, once we did the project, we want to make sure that the restoration was in place because we wanted to treat this as sensitively as we could. And so in conclusion, the native habitat restoration and seeding occurred in March and December 2012 and October 2013. The restoration of rare plant populations was in December 2012, and the second year of restoration monitoring was completed earlier this year in April, with 75% of the sites achieving final restoration. And this photo shows one of the towers in place and a lot of the restoration and the plants coming back. So what I'd like to do is show you a video, and this is about a 60-second video, and this is a helicopter delivering concrete to the site. So by using this method, we didn't have to bring any large trucks up to the site. We didn't have to run any large hoses to pump that concrete. And so those lines are actually energized as this helicopter is coming in. So you can see that it was a very interesting project, and we had to take a lot of care with safety, but making sure that we did this project in a safe and efficient manner. And this is bringing probably about a yard or 2 yards of concrete, and you'll see he'll be bringing this down to the workers that are waiting. The concrete coming down the slough, and he's heading back off. So like I said, bringing the concrete, filling the footing, took less time than it did for me in this presentation.
And that's the only reason I asked. I knew they weren't one-foot footings. I knew that.
Ms. Ray?
How many of those flying towers went by? I mean, I wish I would have seen that, because I would have made up a really good story for my kids.
Well, we replaced 40 towers. And so there was a lot of flying in of the towers to the different sites. You know, frankly, I live in Pismo Beach, and I wasn't assigned to the project from the get-go. About halfway through, I took over managing the environmental compliance aspect of the project. And I remember these helicopters taking off at Pismo's yard there in Pismo Beach. And I'm thinking, what are these helicopters for? And then slowly, not too long after that, I learned what they were for. But there was a lot of flying in of equipment and supplies to get to the different sites, recognizing they were very remote and steep hills to get to it, and much better off using that type of equipment as opposed to having to make a number of improvements to the existing roads or building new roads to get to the sites. So the primary objective was to avoid or minimize impacts, and one of the ways in which we did that was through the use of helicopters.
Well, and that brings me to my next question. So was it economically the right choice to do the environmentally correct thing?
Well, the environmental compliance portion of the project could amount to upwards of 25 to 30% of the total project budget. So a substantial amount of money goes toward the environmental program to make sure that we minimize impacts.
Let me add. So I would just say there certainly was a cost, but as I said earlier, trying to do the right thing. And so we always try and make sure we weigh all the factors in going forward with a project, especially a project like this that's in such an environmentally sensitive area. I can't say we would do this on every project, but I think we try to do the right thing, and, you know, and cost is certainly a factor. But I think in this particular case, doing it environmentally sensitive won out.
This is the first time I've ever heard of a mitigated positive deck.
Yeah, there you go. All right.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we do have a plaque that we'd like to present to the folks from PG&E. With your permission, we'd like to just come up in front of the dais and have you guys join us.
We'd be pleased.
Thank you.
You get to fly in the helicopter?
Yeah. Boy. That's what I want.
That's what I want.
That's what I want.
By the way, here's what it says.
Okay, it is the real deal. Yes.
Step in there, Chris.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks.
Well, pleasure. Thank you. Dr. Havlick, for bringing this fascinating project. Nice to know we can tread lightly and accomplish great things. So appreciate everyone's work on this project. We have two afternoon items. Madam Clerk, when you're ready, if you would introduce our first one, please.
Item number 13, a hearing to consider a resolution approving the assessment for cost recovery and to close the abatement procedures for the Inguido property located at 480 Mesa Grande Drive in the community of Shandon. Resolution number 2013-184, District 1.
All right.
Good afternoon. Greg Kamick with County Planning.
code enforcement. As you may recall, back in July 23rd, 2013, we came before the board to request a nuisance abatement process to take place on the Inguido property there in Shandon. That process was taken care of. The property was cleaned up. The structures were secured. The property was secured. And we are now asking the board, or bringing before the board, an opportunity to collect or bill for cost recovery for the costs taken on by the county. On that project, we are asking that the board approve that and also approve the billing as laid out in the staff report, and that the case can then be closed out.
All right.
And do you have any questions?
Yes, okay. So all the details contained in the staff report as published. I'll ask the board if there are questions. Mr. Kamek?
I would like to add one more detail. I gave to the clerk of the board a revised resolution copy.
Okay.
The copy that was in the agenda.net program was had a minor flaw. This is the corrected.
So clerical correction on the?
Yes, sir.
Okay, very good. With that, questions from the board? Seeing none, I will open it to the public. I have no request to speak. And seeing no one coming forward, I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to thank Greg and the other staff that went
the proceedings today. I was going to say this is a unique undertaking, but it's not. We did one of these about a month ago. This is a public hearing under a section of our code, Title 6, if I remember correctly, that we don't often conduct. We're going to hold a public hearing. We'll start with county staff's presentation of the issues involved. That'll take about 10 minutes. We'll then go to the applicant, which is Sunset Savor, the Central Coast, for a presentation of about 10 minutes. We'll open then to public comment, and then we'll take board questions for the applicant or any of the county departments that are involved. Followed that by closing commentary by both the applicant and county staff, and the board will then bring it back for questions and deliberations. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Erb.
Okay. Good afternoon. Jim Erb, County Auditor Controller, Treasurer Tax Collector. That was a good introduction, Bruce. As Bruce said, we're here to consider a temporary commercial outdoor entertainment license. This is an activity such as a concert, festival, circus, carnival, something that the public is admitted to for a fee. It's attended by more than 3,000 people, and it's not on the grounds of a school or a college or a drive-in theater, and is not an agricultural fair. Like you said, Bruce, it's not unique, although I've been here 24 years, and I think this is the second one that we've done in the last 2 months. This application is for 2 days, for the final 2 days of the event, September 27th and 28th. And it's the main event at Santa Margarita Ranch. It opens at 11 a.m. and is over at 5 p.m. each day. The applicant has requested approval for up to 4,000 ticket holders. And the event showcases the talents of the area's local winemakers, chefs, growers, and artisanal food producers. This is the fifth event that's been held at Santa Margarita Ranch. Under the ordinance process, the tax collector is responsible for assembling the application documents, referring the application documents to the reviewing agencies, accepting the required fees, scheduling the hearing, and then following up on any conditions if the application is approved. So today we have responses from CAL FIRE, Sheriff's Department, County Health, Office of Emergency Services, Planning and Building, and also Public Works. And I'm going to turn it over to Justin Cooley, my principal financial analyst, who will talk about some of the considerations with the application.
Thank you. I am Justin Cooley, also the Auditor Controller, Treasurer Tax Collector's Office. And as you mentioned, we did this about a month ago, so I will kind of summarize these provisions. If you have any questions, please stop me along the way. So under the code section, your board may approve with conditions or deny the license. In order to make those determinations, the ordinance does require that the board make several findings. First of all the materials that are required to be filed with the tax collector have been filed. That the applicant has not knowingly made any false or misleading statements throughout the application process. That issuing this license with any conditions that the board may impose would meet the health, fire, and safety codes of the state and county. That the activity would not unduly endanger property of other persons in the vicinity of the event. That the activity would not be unduly detrimental to the health and safety of those attending or in the vicinity of the event. And finally, that the applicant has submitted adequate evidence that they will comply with sections 6.56130 through 300 of the chapter. Those sections generally regard things like water, sanitation, lighting, that sort of thing. So that concludes our brief presentation at this point, and we understand that Stacy Jacob of Visit San Luis Obispo County is available. They are the applicants for this license.
All right.
Ms. Jacobs,
would you like to present on this application?
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for your time today as we come before you. Hopefully many of you have already attended or been to Sunset Savor the Central Coast over the past 4 years of us doing this event. I wanted to start off and just remind ourselves of how this event really came to us. I have to say that Sunset Savor the Central Coast is truly a unique brand partnership. It brings together many aspects under this umbrella, and it's truly a vision of what we are hoping to do here as we continue to brand our destination, Visit San Luis Obispo County. The partnership is vast and includes Visit San Luis Obispo County as the event organizer. We were very blessed about 6 years ago when we heard that Sunset Magazine wanted to expand their event series. Sunset Magazine is owned by Time, Inc. out of New York, of course, publishers. So the goal, of course, is to continue bringing more people here, not just for the event weekend, but again and again and again back to we know how important tourism is to our area, and that's really what this grand vision is. And then, of course, not to to make sure we talk about our wineries, the artisan food products, chefs, farmers, and all the various exhibitors that see this audience as a likely audience in their mind. It was pretty powerful recently learning about how some of our exhibitors have truly seen increased sales growth as a result of this event over the first 4 years. Again, the highlights of Savor is to create a lifestyle and experiential driven type of demographic. We've seen this positive economic growth of organic growth really happening since 2010, the first year of this event. This four-day experience, it really anchors the last weekend in September. September statewide is considered California Wine Month, so we're excited to bring California Wine Month home right here to San Luis Obispo County, really bringing Savor to life with really featuring our various aspects of coastal, cultural, community, and culinary aspects through the main event, adventure tours, and our special events and dinners. As I mentioned, Savor is really much more than just an event. It's about a brand experience. We have a six-month campaign that generates almost 400 million marketing impressions. What that means is there's a whole lot of buzz being generated about Savor, about San Luis Obispo County from May through September every year, actually through October with all the post-event. That has led to great customer reviews, as we see our customers are willing to come back again and again, and key accolades of being named one of the top five California festivals by the Huffington Post, and the best epicurean event by the Fame Awards, which is an organization that Time Inc. and other publications, this competes with major events like the Aspen Food and Wine Festival. Savor attracts visitors to San Luis Obispo County. One of our key goals is to continue attracting out-of-the-area guests. As we look at the last year, we had about 35% of our guests come from outside the area, about 67% within San Luis Obispo County. I'm still shocked and amazed when folks from San Luis Obispo County have never been to Sunset Savor the Central Coast. So we have an audience right here, but we're also continuing to get that outside of the area audience, which includes over 33 states and Canada represented over our demographic demographics last year, including Southern California and the Bay Area. If you remember the way the event lineup was created, it's much more than just the main event, but 36% of the attendees attend more than one event throughout that four-day weekend of series. As we look at the demographics of the core audience that's coming to Savor, it's a demographic of 45 to 64-year-olds with a high disposable income. Over 60% of the attendees have an average household income of over $100,000. What that means is we're getting the folks with disposable income who want to come here and spend money on the kind of products and services that we offer here in San Luis Obispo County. Every year we do an economic impact study. You've likely read about the impact that this event has on the community. Through the paper, we work with Productive Impact, a San Luis Obispo company, to equate these numbers and look at really what is the average length of stay, how much are people really spending when they come to this area. So we are here before you today to ask that you allow Sunset Savor the Central Coast to continue to grow organically. We have been working with many of the requirements with your state and county agencies really since the inception of this event, working with both Cal Fire, California Highway Patrol, Public and Environmental Health, the ABC, of course, Slow Ambulance and Community Health Partners. Our traffic management plan is something that we've continued to work on and perfect over the years. The other big thing is it's very important to us as we integrate into the community of Santa Margarita. So every year we do our letter that goes out to all residents within Santa Margarita. And I have to say this year what we did is encourage them to come to the event, not just by offering a discount, but we said the first 100 residents who sign up for a Sunday ticket are going to get free entry in on Sunday. And let me tell you, that went with about 48 hours was already. So people are excited about coming to Savor the Central Coast, and people are excited in their own backyard community. We really strive to be a green event. We provide also shuttles to all the major communities throughout the county going to Santa Margarita. So we are here today to answer your questions and really ask for your support as this event continues to grow organically. We are also asking that you consider that not just the one-year support of this, but look at a five-year request for this temporary commercial outdoor entertainment license. What this will do is it will allow us to continue the unique partnership that has been created, will allow us to provide long-term planning opportunities, both with Sunset Magazine, with our sponsors, and, of course, our county and state and agencies as a result of that. I want to thank you for your time, and we're happy to entertain any questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jacob. We'll get to those questions, should there be some, in just a moment. With that, we'll go ahead and take the...
Good afternoon, Chair Gibson, County Supervisors. I'm Charlene Rosales, representing the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. Our chamber wishes to state our support today for the approval of the temporary commercial outdoor entertainment license for Sunset Savor the Central Coast. Savor has grown to be a significant event for our entire region, drawing thousands of visitors to San Luis Obispo County to fill hotel beds, dine at restaurants, taste at wineries and breweries, and to shop in stores. In addition, it brings corporate support in the form of both hard dollars and in-kind donations and allows locals to seek and benefit from job opportunities associated with this event. As we have stated in the past with other activities related to county-issued event licenses and permits, we support the Savor organizers in working with the neighboring community, CHP, Caltrans, private contractors, and others to ensure traffic management and a safe venue for all attendees and the community. We would like to see the event continue to grow as it has been for the past several years, and we encourage your approval of a five-year license for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rosales. Mr. Sullivan.
Good afternoon, members of the board. I'm not here representing any public entity. I'm just here to represent myself and my wife, George Sullivan, resident of the Santa Margarita area. And I just want to publicly support this event. I want to remain a good neighbor of the ranch, as they've been a very good neighbor to our community. And Santa Margarita is growing up as a little community. We have a lot of amenities that have done very well representing this county, as has done this, as this Savor event has done very well for this county as well. So, anyhow, that's it. I just want to go on record of supporting a very good event. location that I discovered Doc Bernstein's Raspberry Malo chocolate truffle ice cream, and that's where I found it. It's a great, right. Great event.
Just be careful with that, Mr. Sullivan. Just be careful. All right, that was our last request to speak. I'll bring it back to the board for a moment.
We
have one more. Ms. Harvey, would you like to address us? Good timing on that.
Thank you so much. Susan Harvey, North County Watch. Road work, like 20 minutes. I just wanted to briefly touch on a few things in my letter. We're particularly concerned about the issue of traffic and hope that you will take our recommendations regarding having traffic come from Santa Barbara area, Santa Barbara Road, and close off the Yerba Buena entrance only to emergency and disabled. And the water issues, extra fire safety, and please limit the maximum to 3,000 and require the left turn lane if you're for future events, for sure. Thank you, and I'll fill this out for you.
Very
thank you.
Thanks so much.
Much.
All right. With that, we'll come back to the board with any questions of either the applicant or any of the departments weighing in on that. Ms. Ray?
Go ahead. Sorry, I didn't see Supervisor Arnold's slide.
No, go ahead. No, please.
I just had a couple questions for the applicants. Just, it's my understanding that Yerba Buena is used only, during this event, used only for your staffing and that sort of thing, and that the attendant, folks that are here to attend the event, use El Camino.
Hi, my name is Jamie Kirk, and I'll be able to answer those questions. The way the traffic management plan has evolved over the years, because we have, this is going to be the fifth year, we've had opportunity to see what works and see what doesn't work. And what we use for Yerba Buena, we will use that for the vendors that come in up until 10 o'clock in the morning, and then the vendors will be directed to the China Gardens entrance, which is at the more the northern end. But we also use Yerba Buena for the bus shuttles. Mm-hmm. So the buses come up and down Yerba Buena, but all other attendee traffic besides handicap will utilize the China Gardens entrance. And we implement a traffic control plan. We've got signage, and we put the signage is placed specifically to get people to get the attendees to move through town and not accidentally turn on Yerba Buena. You know, to Ms. Harvey's suggestion of having the attendees come down and use the Santa Barbara exit, we do have signage on 101 for those that are coming south to get them to exit Santa Barbara. So we have the signage to get them off the Santa Barbara exit and get them coming from the south. And then obviously the people are going south, so then the people coming north will use the Highway 58 exit. So we've really tried to minimize the amount of traffic that's on Yerba Buena, keep it to the buses, just because the roads that are providing access into China Gardens aren't big enough for the buses to come in and out. And
the event. Last year we did have some problems with heat and caused quite a few medical problems out there all at about the same time. And this year we've mitigated that, we believe, also by having that fire engine in as well as some ambulances on site. So we think that we've done everything we can to make sure the event is safe in all ways.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Now
don't go anywhere, Chief.
To Supervisor Ray. Excuse me.
Real quick, one of the things that was in one of our constituent letters was asking that the event be a non-smoking event. Is that a requirement?
Is there zones? I'm going to have Fire Marshal Donnelly come up.
We've required that any smoking that occurs at the event is in designated smoking areas, and I've also had pretty extensive conversations with the event staff that any areas that are outside of that are a possible higher fire hazard area, they're going to have additional fire watch staff, and in the event of conditions during the event, if it's hot, dry, windy, that we can and would restrict further smoking locations.
Okay, thank you. And then for Ms. Kirk, this didn't occur to me until just when Stacy was giving her presentation. There's a couple of groups around the county that are eco-rotary and do zero-waste events. Mm-hmm. Are you willing to do any work or contracting with them for that?
And I will defer to Stacy, but it's my understanding that, it's already being implemented over the years, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, we very much strive for a zero-waste event. We work with Gorilla Gardeners. Kyle Bielwomick, who's with us here today, spends a lot of time talking about trash. For example, one of the key things we do is any pieces that we order in terms of serving food in must be biodegradable. So everything is compostable. We have specific standards in which our exhibitors must follow to be able to participate in our event.
Great, thank you. And lastly, do you have a maximum occupancy as part of this? I haven't seen that anywhere in here. The only mention of anything over 3,000 is just saying the words over 3,000.
We had, with the original permit application, we submitted a request for up to 4,000 attendees, and that was looking at the growth as it's occurred over the years. It's grown about 15 to 20% of attendance per year. We did not reach 3,000 attendees last year, and we expect the attendees to be just over 3,000 this year. But I think that goes back to the request for the five-year license, is that whenever we originally submitted the application, we submitted it for 1 year, and as we were talking through it as a team, we wanted the opportunity to have it for up to 5 years. We were working with Justin at the tax collector's office, and he indicated that we're going to need to revise all of our paperwork, you know, change the dates if we knew what those dates were going to be. And it got a little complicated, and it was going to delay our permit approval time frame, where we wouldn't be coming back to your board probably till the end of August, if not sometime in September. We were concerned of reworking all the paperwork, but we still think it's within the board's ability to look at this and approve the five-year permit today if it's up to...
I'm not asking about the five-year
permit. And then I'm getting to that, is that we see the attendance growing, you know, 15% a year, which would maybe put us up to over 5 years to about 5,000 people, 5 to 6,000.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Meacham?
I wonder if County Council could weigh in on the five-year issue.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Council. We did become aware a month or so ago that there may be a request for a five-year permit. We advised the applicants that if they would like a five-year permit, that they needed to revise their application. A couple of reasons for that. One, the ordinance specifically says you need to identify the specific dates upon which you want the event. That would have also then provided further information to the referring agencies. But most importantly, the notice that goes out pursuant to the ordinance and that goes out to the adjoining landowners sets the specific dates. So for those people who may have wanted to comment on this item or have been interested in it, we needed to give them notice of the specific dates and that this was a five-year request. So we were very concerned that if the application doesn't identify a request for 5 years of specific dates, that there may be some due process issues that we may not be able to overcome. So our recommendation today is that the application is for a one-year request.
Thank you. And Jamie, in that regard, could Saver put together an application that would identify specific time frames in which this would take place, or is that difficult to accomplish with the Sunset Magazine?
Well, nothing is ever certain as far as dates for events. But what's happened the last 5 years is it has happened the last weekend of September. And, you know, if the board is not willing to approve the five-year permit today that we were hoping to get so that we could give certainty to Sunset and certainty to those that are participating, I think our other option is to just come in quickly for another, just to be ahead of the game for next year, to come in with a five-year permit, hoping that our date.
I have a couple questions for the auditor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I can't remember the order, much less all the terms. In terms of granting this permit, there's no specific resolution as we would find in a land use permit. And the staff report references preparing a board order to authorize the permit under Title VI that we deal with. Am I to assume that the conditions that are attached to this event in terms of mitigating the impacts of traffic, of noise, of water use, fire danger, et cetera, are contained in the specifics of the plan that's submitted as part of the application, and those become binding on the event applicant, you know, when such permit is authorized.
Yes, that would be correct.
Okay.
Those would be binding.
And further, not having heard anything in your staff report, I assume that the conditions that are listed in the application now satisfy all the concerns that were expressed by agencies that commented on that.
It looks like Rita has a comment on this.
Ms. Neal.
Rita Neal, County Council. I think probably the best way to do this is one, first of all, the application asks for up to 4,000, so the board might want to identify as a condition of the permit the maximum number. I would also suggest that if you're going to make a motion to approve it, that you approve it pursuant to the application and in addition to the requirements that were placed on by the other agencies, which I think is attachment B.
Right.
So those
okay.
would also be conditions.
Okay, very good. I think that's wise, but I see no conflict. I've not heard expressed any conflict between the requirements expressed by the agencies that reviewed and the applicant at this point.
That's correct.
So if we finished questions from the board, we can bring it back then for closing comments. Does Ms. Jacob or anybody from SAVOR have any closing comments on this? For 5 minutes? No? And staff, any wrap-up comments? With that, I'll bring it back to the board and supervisor of the district, Ms. Arnold.
Yep. So I just want to say, you know, the past few years that SAVOR's been part of the community of Santa Margarita, it really has been a well-run event. And I remember the first year, the buzz all around town, everyone in Santa Margarita was so excited that Sunset Magazine was coming to little old Santa Margarita. My family, we don't now, but at that time, my kids had a tasting room there in Santa Margarita, and all the businesses were so excited to have all these people from Los Angeles and other places come and see the town and spend their money. But the event was structured so that they didn't really ever come downtown, and so you sort of watched from afar with all the visitors. So I know that some of the folks have mentioned today, you know, that they want the town not to be impacted by the event. And I'm just saying from experience that there are some people in the town that do want the visitors. Maybe that's not their destination point. The downtown is not their destination point in this case. But I think some of the businesses there hope that maybe another time that those visitors will remember Santa Margarita and come and shop and spend their money and eat there. And I think that's what this event really brings to the entire county. It's like a sampler of the county, and lots of the vendors from all over the county, they're able to kind of show off what they have, and we're able to kind of show off our wonderful scenery and places to visit. And as a tourism economy here in the county, I think it's just a wonderful thing. Like I say, a sampler for people to see what they can come back to see at another time. So all that being said, I'd like to make the motion to approve this application for up to 4,000 people under the conditions in Attachment B. How's that motion sound? Are we good?
Second. Well, let's see. I was going to say, let's see about our colleagues, and we do have a second. So
I
think it sounds pretty good.
I was going to tell you, I did have to send SAVOR a bill. After the first time I went, then I had to go buy chickens and a chicken coop. I had to make a chicken coop after my wife saw all that. I don't know. Second.
And under discussion, I just wanted to say this is a very well put together application. Thank you for that. And the events issue has been an issue in this county, and this is an event that is a good representation for what a larger event with the proper circulation in the proper place actually looks like. So thank you for that.
Very good. Madam Clerk, are you clear on the motion?
Approving the application means that the findings are being made, all of them, number two, and you're approving number three and four?
Along with a maximum attendance of 4,000 and the mm-hmm. conditions as expressed by the agencies in Exhibit
and
E?
B, correct. Okay.
Is Exhibit B, Attachment 2, whatever, one of those two. We know what we're talking about.
Okay.
With that, then, Madam Clerk, a roll call vote, please.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Excuse me.